This is Steve Maxner conducting an interview with Mr. Michael Maria. It is the 7th of December, the year 2000, at 1:30 Lubbock time. I am in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library. Mr. Maria is in Palm Harbor, Florida. All right, sir, would you please begin by giving a brief biographical sketch of yourself?
Yeah. I was born in the Bronx, New York City, on the 22nd of March, 1940, which makes me 60 years of age. Was born into a fairly typical Bronx family, middle class, maybe just a tad below middle class in terms of financial situation. My dad was an engineer for the U.S. Navy, worked at the Brooklyn Navy Yard for most of his life. Started off as a draftsman and ended up as a department supervisor. My mom was just a homemaker. Never worked outside the house, at least not well I can recall. I had a younger brother named Charles or Chuck. He's about 2 years younger than I am, and a younger sister, Dorothy, who is about 4 years younger than I am. Both still living. My childhood, we were a Catholic family, fairly active, practicing Catholics, and so my early childhood revolved around things going on in the neighborhood, in the street, in the vacant lots that we played in, and in the school that I went to, which was the parochial school, the church school for my parish. So I spent the first, from the age of 5 or 6 until 13 or so, primarily as a student in Blessed Sacrament Grammar School, which was associated with my church, as I said. Again, a fairly typical childhood, had a very good time when I wasn't studying. I was a pretty good student, actually one of the better students in my class, but I had a good time on weekends and whatnot, just playing as kids do, either in makeup games or playing semi-organized sports. We didn't have much in the way of serious organized sports. We just made up our own games and played in schoolyards and vacant lots and in the street. Let's see, what else would you like to know?
Well, I was curious. Another gentleman that I've talked to recently talked about going, as he put it, he called it alley exploring. Did you ever do anything like that?
No, we had alleys, which was just the space between two apartment buildings, but there wasn't much in them, so we didn't explore much. Most of our exploring, if you will, was in the vacant lots, which there were many in the neighborhood, and they were a lot more interesting because they were wild. They had rocks and puddles and trees and swamps and places you could hide and make up games. So so most of the time we were in the vacant lots or just out in the street playing the classic New York City games, stick ball and punch ball and stoop ball, all of which are described in other places, but that was it. You know, writing, one thing that comes to mind is there were seasons, it seemed like, for everything. It seemed like on a certain day in the spring, everybody would put away a certain toy, whatever it was, and the new one would come out. So the bicycles might go away for a while, and the skates would come out. And then it seemed almost on signal that 2 months later or a month and a half later, the skates would go away and the ball gloves would come out.
Okay.
And there seemed to be a pattern that we followed without really realizing it. But play was a large part of our life when we weren't in school or at home doing our homework or what have you. Particularly on weekends, I guess, or in the summer when the days were longer and we were out of school. And back in those days, kids were out of school for a longer period in the summer than they are today. I think we had pretty much 3 full months, which they don't get anymore.
Now, I noticed on one of the questionnaires you filled out, your paternal grandparents came to the United States from Italy.
Yes, that's true.
Did you have much contact with them as you
grew up? Yeah, they were the family. My dad had 1, 2, 3 brothers, and a sister, all of more or less the same age, and they all lived reasonably nearby, say, well, in the early days, within 30-minute subway ride, and probably never more than an hour from some central point. And that central point, especially when I was very young, was frequently my grandparents' place, which was just a tiny little tenement apartment on Lincoln Avenue in the Bronx. But it was packed with people when we all got together, and that was fairly frequent for dinner and whatnot, probably once a month or so. And it was just packed, nobody ever seemed to get in anybody's way, and the kids did their thing while the adults did theirs. And all I can remember of it, or what I generally remember of it, is that we all had a very good time. Nobody ever got mad at anybody, and it was just a lot of fun. So I did have, to answer your question, yeah, I did have contact with them. My grandmother, paternal grandmother, was a very typical Italian immigrant housewife, spoke almost no English, mm-hmm. spent most of her life, it seemed, in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. My grandfather was, of course, went out and earned a living. He did several things, but primarily he worked for a piano manufacturing company, Singer Pianos. Okay. And of course, he learned English, so he was easier to communicate with. Unfortunately, never knew his real story, and it's too late to find it now. But it, looking back, seemed to be a well-educated man. Loved the opera, big old standard radio that everybody had, console radio. And Sunday afternoons, the operas were always on, and that was a big interest to him. Mm-hmm. I remember him. He lived long enough to see me graduate from college and get commissioned, and of course I was the first in the family to go to college, so that was a big thing for him. Mm-hmm. And I do remember him up to those years. Unfortunately, never sat down and had a real long talk with him, sort of like this, mm-hmm. and found out who he really was and what he'd really done and why he immigrated and all of those sorts of things. So.
Okay. Oh, you read my mind. That's what I was going to talk to you about. Okay, so you're not certain about the circumstances surrounding why he immigrated?
No, except that an awful lot of Italians were. He came from the southeast part of Italy, near Bari, and, you know, just hordes of Italians were immigrating. Mm-hmm. I've seen a few movies about that time period in Italy. Things were very bad economically. Mm-hmm. And that's still today, as Italy goes, a poor part of Italy. So I imagine it was economic. There may have been some political overtones as well, because there was still a king back then in Italy, and in one of the few countries in Europe that had a really powerful king still. But I don't know. I wish I did. I wish I knew what the reasons were.
Just out of curiosity, do you know about any of the hardships or difficulties he had when he got to the United States?
No, I never got the impression that things were too difficult. That he moved to an Italian neighborhood, had friends and acquaintances and probably a few cousins who had preceded him, and they sort of took care of the new guy, and I think he found work quickly. The economic circumstances were never great, but they lived well. I think the apartment probably was 600 square feet. It was that big. It was not big at all. Right. And on about the third or fourth floor of a building, a typical tenement building, but I don't think we ever knew we were poor. We didn't suffer from it anyway, because everybody we knew was in the same boat.
Right.
Yeah, so... No, I don't think there was any serious hardship for either of them. I think they got here and hit the ground running, and things got progressively better. Their children got good jobs, although never finished college, any of them, and raised good families. And then their grandchildren mostly did go to college, so it was a good progression. I think they were very satisfied.
Okay. And when you left high school, and did you know immediately that you'd be going straight into college?
From grade school, I went, as I said, I was pretty good with the books.
Okay.
And I was selected. There's a process in New York City. There's a Jesuit high school called Regis High School. It's on 84th Street, I think, near Central part. And that school run by the Jesuits used to pick the two top academic kids from basically every grade school in the city of New York and would collect them together in this one high school, tuition free, and the education was very, very good because the academic standards were extremely high. And I went there for 3 years, and at the end of my junior year, the principal called me in and basically said, "Mike, you're not making it here. You know, nice try, but you're just not handling, particularly Latin. Third year Latin killed me." So he politely suggested that I go somewhere else, and I did. I finished my fourth high school year at Cardinal Hayes, which is the big standard isn't quite the right word, but the Catholic high school in the Bronx where everybody went if they went to Catholic high school. Okay. And so I graduated from Cardinal Hayes in, 57. Mm-hmm. So I was still fairly young. But by then, again, I was still pretty good academically, mm-hmm. and it was pretty clear that I was going to at least have a shot at college,
okay.
Which I did. I went, I was only just, 18, I guess, that summer before I started college, and really didn't have a clue as to what I wanted to do, which is typical, for a kid that age. So I started in engineering school at New York University, which is the Uptown, what they call the Uptown campus in the Bronx, intending to go into aeronautical engineering. And that's kind of a funny story. After a year there, I went to the dean this time, Dean Cunningham, I'll never forget it, and I told him I was going to quit. I said I just couldn't take it. And he asked me why, and he said you're not burning the buildings down, but you're not flunking out either. He says you're doing okay. Mm-hmm. And he said, "Why do you want to quit?" And I told him, I said, "I just can't stand it. What I couldn't deal with is that everything was graded on a curve. And so if you walked into a physics class and took an exam and, the mean grade was 20, you got a C." But to my mind, I only knew 20% of what I was supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
I just couldn't deal with that. So I told him that, and he said, "Okay, I understand." He said, "Anything I can do for you?" And I said, "Yeah, if you just call the dean down at the business school," which was downtown in Greenwich Village, "I'd sure like to go there starting, next semester."
Mm-hmm.
And so he did, and I did, and I graduated. I know I'm jumping around a bit, but I graduated 4 years later, which was difficult because I had to make up a lot of credits in the business school credits that I had taken in the engineering school in the first year didn't really play into the curriculum at the business school, so I had to really double up. I think there were times I was taking 21 credits. As a matter of fact, several semesters probably, which today people don't believe, but it's true. 21 credit hours to get caught up and still graduate in 4 years, which I did. But probably the most significant thing is that, this is another funny story. While I was still at the Uptown campus, a green kid wandering around in a daze, they were passing out the class, what were the class cards. And, of course, if you were going in a certain path, you had to take this, and you had to take that, and you had to take this, and you had a choice between one or two things. And one of those choices, there was a girl student working to make a few dollars at the end of the table where they were passing out these class cards. And when you got to the end, she said to me, "Do you want PT or ROTC?" And I said, to myself, "I know what PT is. That's running across the campus sweaty after a shower and athlete's foot and, trying to get from one class to another." I said, "I don't really need to do that. What's this ROTC?" And she said, "Well, it's some sort of a military training thing." And that's all she knew. And I said, "That sounds good. Give me the card." So that, believe it or not, is the extent of the thought that it went into my 30-year military career, because where it began.
Oh, my goodness.
It's an honest-to-God true story.
Oh.
I took the card, and she said, "Go over there." There was a little hill. There's a building on the other side of the hill. There's a tailor over there, tailor shop. You go in there, and they give you uniforms, and then you show up at your class as the card indicated, and you'll be on your way. Mm-hmm. So that's how it all began. And of course, even when I transferred downtown, I just stayed in ROTC because I was enjoying it. It had a lot to offer. It was interesting, something I hadn't done, and free airplane rides and things like that on occasion with the instructors. And mm-hmm. and so slowly but surely, it grew on me, I guess, and to the point where, I guess by junior year, it was a definite career option. Mm-hmm. I was qualified to be a pilot physically and mentally, and that looked like a good thing to do. It looked like a fun thing to do. So basically just evolved into it at graduation. It was graduate and be commissioned and still qualified, so I had orders to wait through the summer, which would have been the summer of 61, and then report to pilot training in October of 61, which I did. Mm-hmm. So,
okay.
I know I leaped through that
rapidly,
okay.
Yeah.
but that is kind of a comical story because it's absolutely true.
Now, did you have any regrets in the end in terms of your switch to business?
No. It was at that point, to be perfectly honest, it was just a way of getting a degree for me. I don't really think that I had any great desire. Let's pretend, for example, that the military thing had fallen through. Let's say I had something physically or whatnot had gone wrong toward the end, and I didn't get pilot training. I don't know under those circumstances if I'd have still gone in the military. I think not. Mm-hmm. And so at that point, I would have had to use my degree, which was an accounting degree, mm-hmm. and just go into the accounting world in New York City. I would have done it. I probably would have been, as happy as the next guy doing it, mm-hmm. but it certainly wasn't anything I had a burning desire to do. Particularly after becoming acquainted with the military thing, the idea of a coat and tie and riding the subway for 20, 30 years every day to the same office or the same general area didn't hold a lot of attraction to me. Mm-hmm. So I got the degree because you needed a degree to be an officer, and it was a good degree, but never really used it until much, much later in my life, after I retired 30-some-odd years later.
Wow. Now, and how far into ROTC did you realize that was the point where you're going to make a military career?
Oh, probably about the beginning of junior year.
Okay.
I would say it started to look, first of all, you could begin to see the end. You knew you had 2 years of college left, and mm-hmm. and at that point, you start to take physicals and exams, and things were, the indicators were all saying, "Hey, you can do this." And of course, you start to get encouragement from the staff as well. And so it all sort of comes together, mm-hmm. or at least in my case, it did.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, when you were going through ROTC, what kind of instruction did you receive in terms of military history, and what did they talk about in terms of military, wars in particular? Did they talk about the Korean War or Second World War? Which did they emphasize more?
That's a good question. I don't think we studied, there's no way to know anymore, but my recollection is that we didn't literally study wars as wars.
Okay.
I think we studied some political science with a bias toward war in general, and by that I mean political science going way back to the beginning, maybe some Roman philosophy and Chinese philosophy and that sort of thing, of politics as it affects war and war as it affects politics. So I think it was a broader look at the subject than to just study a war.
Okay.
I don't think we talked about war much at all. The faculty, the ROTC faculty, were veterans of the Second World War. In at least one case, there was a colonel named Desper, D-E-S-P-E-R, Dale, I believe is his first name, who was a World War II vet, and because World War II wasn't that far distant back then.
Mm-hmm.
One or two of the other professors of air science, the younger guys, maybe captains, might have had some Korean service, but it wasn't something that was talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Specific wars weren't, at least not in my recollection. We studied military organization. We studied military protocols and what's the word I'm groping for here? Tradition, yeah, military traditions and things of that sort, but not specific wars, I recall.
Hmm. Now, did you, as a young man growing up, as a boy growing up, were you at all interested in that type of stuff?
Not intensely, but that's an interesting question too. In later life, I've asked myself that question. You know, what was there something else in my upbringing that may have pointed me in that direction unconsciously. There may have been one or two things. I'll tell you what they are, and they again are kind of amusing. I was given a book on my ninth birthday by, I think, one of my uncles, and you'd have to understand that's 1949, so the Second World War is only over a couple of years. And there were a whole series of books coming out for boys back in those days, kind of action adventure books. One of them was about a naval aviator out in the Pacific. Red Randall at Midway is the name of the book. And I remember just that book just fascinated me, and I probably read it a dozen times, to the point where actually just recently I got on the Internet. There's a site called Alibris, A-L-I-B-R-I-S, which I think in Latin means from the library of or some such thing. They sell old books, and I was actually able to find and buy a almost mint copy of this old book, and I have it at my desk.
Oh, wow.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah, so there may have been something there. My folks, here's another one. When I was real little, maybe 5 or 6, I remember I was as a present I got one of these toys, but it's a big toy. It's a toy. It's a riding toy.
Mm-hmm.
That you may not even be familiar with, but back usually they come in the form of trains or fire engines or whatnot, and the little kid sits in it and pedals it and makes it go down the street.
Oh, yeah.
Well, mine was an airplane, and it had little stubby wings, and the propeller went around when you pedaled it, and it had a couple of little guns up on the front. And I remember enjoying that thing to the point, again, where I got on the Internet to see if I could find one, and I actually found one in an antique shop in state of Washington, some crazy named town like Washomish or some such thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe it or not, mint condition, but $10,000. It's probably the only one left in the world. But I got some pictures of it, at least off the Internet. So who knows? You know, who knows what influences you? At LaGuardia Airport wasn't that far from where I lived, and when I was a teenager, we used to drive out there, myself and my friends, and watch the airplanes take off and land. But nothing intense. There was no aviation background in the family or anything of the sort. There may have been one or two little things, but it's hard to say. Mm-hmm. I won't say yes, I won't say no.
Now, did you have relatives that served in the military during the Second World War?
The only one was one of my dad's younger brothers. My uncle Jerry, or Jerome was his real name, actually Girolamo in Italian, and then Jerome and Jerry. But yes, he was in the Navy during the war, and was a clerk, because that was the kind of work he had done in civilian life, just getting started, really. But he worked in an advertising agency, and so he was a clerk type, typist and whatnot, and at least for part of his service, I know it was on the Missouri, on the battleship Missouri. May have been after the war, actually, that he was on the Missouri.
Okay.
I've seen some pictures of him in Paris, so I know he got around a little bit, but no action to speak of that he ever talked about anyway.
Okay.
But he was the only one. The rest of them, of course, my dad was at the Navy Yard, so he was, you know, considered essential in that job. And I, one of my other uncles was a machinist, I think, at an aircraft plant out on Long Island and what have you. So
another essential.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, while we're on the subject of family members in the military, did your brother ever go in the military as well?
My brother served a couple of years, just Army. He enlisted and served... what time frame would that have been? That's a good question. It's a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
It was pre-Vietnam. I'm guessing that he was in the service during my early service days as well. So maybe 59, 60, 61, somewhere in there, but I really don't remember. He was young. I mean, he was just a kid out of high school.
Mm-hmm.
And he did 2 years and got out.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So... your junior year in ROTC, you're at that point, or your junior year in college, excuse me, you're at the point where you can choose. You've gone 2 years, and you don't have to continue.
That's right.
And you've
I chose to continue, and because you know I could start to see that at least it was interesting, and I was involved.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I at the end, I was the cadet commander of the detachment in my senior year.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, was the, what would you say, I guess the reviewing, cadet at the graduation parade, which was they combined the two campuses for the ROTC graduation. So the graduation was actually up at the, Uptown campus, the engineering school campus.
Okay.
And I was the senior guy there.
Okay.
Senior cadet, obviously. Okay. Yeah, and which helped me get, I was actually a distinguished graduate as well from the ROTC program, which was useful because it accelerated the transition from a reserve officer to regular officer once I went on active duty. And that turned out to be useful for promotions and other things years later, because back in those days there was a real distinction between a reserve officer who was sort of looked on as a not fully committed kind of a guy. I don't think that was fair, but that's the way it was. And a guy who could more easily just send back home if requirements diminished. But once you were a regular, you were kind of fully on board. So I got my regular commission fairly quickly, partly as a result of that distinguished graduate thing. It's funny on an interview like this, the things that you spring to mind that you haven't thought about in ages.
Yes, sir. Now, at that point, when you graduated from college, which was
June 7th of 61, if 61. I'm not mistaken. Yeah.
So interesting international events have taken place, and as a college student, you hopefully maybe were aware of these things. The fall of China. That was, of course, earlier. Before you were in college, but the lead up to communism, the communist threat, the lead up to the Cold War, and the major events in the 50s, like the launch of Sputnik. Were these things that you were cognizant of?
Yes, cognizant of all of those. A little bit, you know, how college students generally are. You know, they were sort of... vague, distant things that adults dealt with. I don't think we really saw ourselves as adults quite yet. We were more interested in girls and beer and graduating, to be perfectly honest. We were aware of them. Again, back to a previous question you asked, another thing that we did study pretty intensely in the ROTC program was the various political systems. And of course, the communism was much more of a... an accepted threat generally in the population than it was later on. So we did study it pretty intensely almost to the point, I think, where we were probably propagandized. But I think we knew it and said, that's fine, you know.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you as cadets, as students, would talk about the fact that, you know, this is kind of extreme? Or how did
Let's see.
I guess you could,
extreme, no. I don't even know if we used the phrase then, but the current phrase would be Mickey Mouse. You know, you'd say, come on, guys, you know, I'm I'm older than that. You don't have to spoon feed this stuff to me. I suspect that there were times where we felt that way. Yeah,
mm.
Yeah.
Okay.
But we've, you know, you put up with it. It's all easier to put up with it than argue.
Yes, sir.
The one thing that I do recall, again, now that you sort of stimulated my thinking, was of course the civil rights thing was starting to be big, and particularly on the college campuses, and NYU was no exception. And some of the more radical groups, and they were, all the groups were represented on the campus, NAACP and whatnot, but the ones I remember as being the more radical core was one, Congress on, I'm not sure which, racial equality.
Yes, sir.
And some of those were fairly radical and vocal, and we, as I think frequently happens, rather than create harmony or anything, I think the radicalism of those just drove wedges between people who ordinarily wouldn't have had wedges, you know. But some of the black kids, and there were a few back in, even in those days, in the ROTC program, not the numbers that you would get today, because, you know, there weren't that many black kids in universities back then, but I would say, to be honest, that whereas prior to the appearance of those organizations on the campus, you know, a black guy would just be another guy, once those organizations got there and started espousing their own philosophies, it was like, okay, that's your philosophy, and if you want to go that way, it's been nice knowing you. It really, I think, did drive some wedges, at least between some people.
So in your experience, the more radical groups tended to polarize?
No question about it, in my mind anyway. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. They certainly weren't, you know, and I think that's probably still true today.
Mm-hmm.
They're not conciliators. They tend to polarize. Yeah.
Now, I'm curious, what was the size of your Corps of Cadets?
I don't remember. It was, I can give you roughly, it started big because of the fact that everybody had to either do the PT or the ROTC. So I would say the freshman group downtown, which I have a better recollection of, was numbered in the hundreds, certainly. But when we graduated, my best recollection is the senior class was two numbers in my head, 11 or 13. It was somewhere in that neighborhood. So there were, of that, several hundred who came in the door, so to speak, as freshmen, we only commissioned, say, 10 or 11 guys.
Wow.
So it shrunk considerably, as you suggested, at that mandatory to non-mandatory point between sophomore and junior year.
Mm-hmm.
And then it shrunk even, you know, some more just by attrition, physicals and things like that, as you march toward the actual, you know, commissioning date.
Mm-hmm.
But several hundred anyway, and I think when we put the whole thing together for graduation up at Washington Heights, which was the uptown campus, I'm just trying to picture it, but it was 500 people, maybe more than that, all together. I'm trying to picture the graduation parade, and it was a large number of people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, just as you were getting close to graduation, Kennedy was elected president in office.
Right.
What did that have an effect on you?
No, none whatever that I can recall.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we were pretty much politics wasn't a big thing on the campus, even though we were in a major city and in fact in Greenwich Village, and a lot of times, you know, after hours, after class, or on a Friday night or whatnot, we'd wind up down in the village in one of the more famous old places, you know, where there was a lot of, relatively speaking at least, a lot of radical thought and that sort of thing. But again, I think we tended, folk music was becoming a big issue, not an issue, but a factor back in those days. And I think we were more interested in the atmosphere than in the substance. You know, we'd rather go to a place where maybe a young Joan Baez was singing and nobody had ever heard of her, but there she was. or Woody Guthrie, or you know, some of those folks, or go to a nightclub and listen to a comedian like Woody Allen, who was a nobody, an unknown back in those days, and have a few beers, than really take anything seriously. I think on that note, I think when the civil rights thing started to really get active, I think it was a little bit, actually maybe a shock to us that these people were serious, where, you know, we were just sort of having a good time. It was the attitude was almost like, hey, lighten up and relax and enjoy life. What are you getting all excited about? You know, of course we didn't understand their point of view, but so I think it was, you know, I guess I'm painting a not too a not too pleasant picture of what we were. I guess we're just, you know, kind of scatterbrained, you know, college kids having a good time. But that's probably pretty accurate. Mm-hmm.
Just out of curiosity, you mentioned some folk singers and stuff.
Yeah.
Did you ever see or hear of Phil Oakes?
OCHS.
Right.
Yeah, the name rings a bell. I'm not sure I could put him in context, but
okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, the substance of the message of a lot of the folk songs and stuff was kind of contrary to the military. Did that not?
Well, not in the college days, because the Vietnam War wasn't on yet.
Okay.
It was just beginning.
Okay.
There was beginning. It was more of the anti-nuclear back in those days. Vietnam was not an issue, but you're right.
Anti-Vietnam, but anti-military, anti-war.
Anti-war, for sure.
Yeah.
And on the campus, there were probably, and again, being a New York City school, fairly liberal, and we shared the campus with the liberal arts school as well, so there were probably some people that looked at us like we were a little strange, but if they did, they were in a world different than ours, and it was just a sort of a live and let live thing. We it wasn't antagonistic.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't hang around with them anyway, so it was kind of irrelevant as to what they thought.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in the early stages back in those days. It was still almost friendly and pleasant. You know, the music wasn't really strident. Except for the Corps, Congress, et cetera, they got pretty strident pretty early. And again, that was more of a shock to us than anything else. The other thing, in the other cases, it was sort of a live and let live kind of an attitude. And we'd go down and listen to the anti-nuclear and anti-war folk singers and enjoy them as much as anything else. And it wasn't a bother. You know, it wasn't a conflict kind of a thing.
I see.
Yeah. Am I making any sense?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay,
absolutely.
Good. Yeah, I wasn't sure.
So as you neared graduation, you knew you were going to be going active duty.
Yeah.
What did your family think of that?
You have some good questions. Okay, well, see, my dad wasn't crazy about it. My mom was, you know, she's just a housewife. She just, whatever was, happened. She wasn't going to have a very strong opinion one way or the other. Or if she did, she never expressed it. But my dad, of course, was becoming, well, by that time he was probably a middle kind of a guy, maybe a GS-9 or 10 or so at that point. And in the engineering department there at the Navy Yard. And in the context of his job, he had more than once gone out on aircraft carriers on shakedown cruises, where they would, after they'd put it, he was in refrigeration and air conditioning engineering.
Mm-hmm.
So after they'd put the system in, you'd always have to go out on the ship on a real cruise and turn the thing on and find out what you forgot and what you did wrong and where you put things in the wrong place and all of that sort of thing and make modifications. So in the context of doing that, he'd had several cruises on carriers and had watched a lot of Navy pilots whacking their airplanes into various parts of the aircraft carrier.
Mm-hmm.
So his impression, I guess, of military flying was that. And he was nervous. I'm sure, maybe even more than nervous, maybe a little bit frightened about it. But, and I would say he probably let me know that, but not in a way where I was going to feel guilty or anything. It was just, you know, he was worried, and I knew it, and I was going to go do it, and he knew it, and so it was an accommodation that never turned into a problem. But he was worried, yes. And in pilot training, he and my mom, I think, came down to Alabama more than once just to visit. And, you know, watching, you know, his little baby kid, you know, with all his gear on, strapping him into this monster machine and actually flying around in it. I don't think he ever really believed it was happening. You know, it would jump ahead, but to finish the thought, you know, when I went to Vietnam, obviously that was a big scare. We got through it. It never became a problem for the family. It was just I knew they were worried, and that was it. Yeah.
Okay. So, why don't you go ahead and describe your entry into the active Air Force?
Okay. Well, the last summer after graduation, of course, I had basically nothing to do, and I went to work at a beach club in the Bronx that I had actually worked at every summer from my 13th year. So I'd worked there 8 summers as a lifeguard primarily, but I'd done some other things to it, helped manage the cafeteria for a while and helped with the electrician and various things. Mainly I was a lifeguard, and I did that my last summer. And then came the date. Now, the orders came and said report to Craig Air Force Base in Selma, Alabama on, I think, the 3rd of October of 61, which I did. I jumped on an airplane out of New York, as I recall. I think it was a Constellation, one of those, you know, three-piece tail airplanes that you see in history books now, and flew down to Atlanta, which was a little tiny, relatively at least, a little nothing town back in those days, and then caught a connecting flight to Montgomery, Alabama, and then I think I took a bus from Montgomery to Selma. Matter of fact, I know I did. And got to Selma in the middle of the night, and that, you know, culture shock wasn't the first time, but it wasn't the last time, but it was the first time to get off a bus at not that late at night, maybe 9:30 at night in Selma, Alabama, and literally the streets were rolled up. Standing there looking around, it looked like a deserted town, but I found somebody who helped me get to the base, which was, as I recall, maybe 5 miles outside of Selma. So basically made my way down there, you know, just a 21-year-old kid out on his way to see the world, and got to the base and, you know, standard procedure, checked in and was assigned a room. And as I recall, this is a little bit vague in my mind, but as I recall now, it's coming back. I got there and was assigned a room in a long, one of these old-style long barracks buildings where the bachelor officers were, and my class was in one building. The bachelors in my class were in one, but most of the guys were bachelors, but there were several married. And I was given a room, and as I recall now, there were guys who had gotten there a day or two ahead of me, just kind of wandering around, and, you know, we sort of introduced ourselves and dropped our bags and figured out who we were and where we came from and talked about what we thought the future was going to hold and that sort of thing. But within, got to be just a day or two, I think we got right into the program. They didn't waste a lot of time just sitting around. We got right into academics and flying, best I recall, almost immediately, maybe a week or two of academics before we started flying, but it wasn't much. And we were off to the races there in pilot training. Every situation you get into has a set of stories associated, you know, people and stories, most of them funny. Fortunately, I've always said the human mind seems to forget the bad ones and remember the good ones, or the funny ones at least. So, but it was pilot training to me was what was it? It was days of hard work. The academics were never a problem for me. Some guys had real fits with the academics, and everybody's a college graduate, and which I guess surprised me a little. For me, the academics were a breeze. really, the, well, back up a step, the program then, I think, was generally laid out in three paths. They had what they called academics, they had what they called leadership or officership, and then they had the flying. The academics were easy, as I said. The leadership, officership, I was junior, so it really hardly had an effect on me. The more senior guys, maybe there were a couple of captains who had been in the service for some years and had applied and gotten accepted for pilot training, so they were the class leaders. They had more of a set of responsibilities and you know, had some problems to deal with time to time. They were kind of the go-between between the most of the students and the faculty, because they were, you know, officers with some experience and in the class, so they sort of acted as a buffer. And they did. They had some serious functions to perform, but for the ordinary guy, you just basically kept your nose clean, and the officership part of the program wasn't difficult either. Then you get to the flying, and of course everybody has their own skills. I would say I was certainly not the most skilled pilot who ever came down the pike. You know, they talk about guys with golden hands, and I was not one of them. I did fine. How would you describe it? I was I'm trying to think of an analogy, like if I were a painter, you know, I certainly wasn't a Van Gogh, but I could do a decent painting, I guess, you know. I got along, I didn't make any mistakes, I did things right, I didn't have any flair for it, and that reflected in you know, where I finished up in the pile, you know, somewhere about in the middle. I wasn't a bad pilot, I wasn't, you know, going to be a fighter pilot either. Only a few guys washed out of the class, as I recall, from the beginning batch. Most of them, I think, SIE, which term you may probably familiar with, is self-initiated elimination. It just means, you know, the guy quit. I don't think the program actually, you know, took too many guys aside and said, you know, you're just not making it. Okay. But it was fun. It was every day was a little different, and usually split up in at least three parts. So we'd have academics in the morning, and then fly in the afternoon, or vice versa. And there was a pretty active athletic program, intramural athletic program. You know, between the various classes that were in various stages of progression there at Craig, and I don't remember how many, but. I think they probably brought a new class in every 2 months. It may have been every month. So you may have had, actually on the base, as many as, I don't think it would have been 12, but maybe 10 classes working their way through from the very beginning to the end. It may have been 8. I honestly don't remember. But we had a very active intramural program and just a very active physical fitness and physical training program. So between those three, your typical work day was, plus studying in the evening, at least a little, your day was full. You got up early, you went to bed not very late because you had to get up early again, and it was a full day. And then on the weekends, on the other hand, it got crazy. I mean, we were just, you know, young and, you know, fearless and flying airplanes and... And so we did crazy things on the weekends, and Selma, like any other town, provided anything you wanted. A lot of drinking, probably drank a lot more than we should have, and driving with a lot more beer in us than we should have, but we survived it. There were clubs around where you could go and get a decent meal. Some of the guys dated locally. Some didn't. One or two guys even married locally before the program was over. In my case, casually, I actually, it's funny, again, there's another thing pops in your head. I dated a couple of girls in town, nice girls, very casually. If there was a party at the club and I needed a date, I'd call one of them up, that kind of a thing. There was, I think the name was Torrenson, or that's at least a decent pronunciation. Colonel Torrenson was a commander on the base. I don't recall his exact function. He may have been the base commander. He may have been the flying wing commander. I honestly don't remember. Mm-hmm. But he had a cute daughter who was just a little younger than me, and they were Catholics, and I guess I met her at church or something. And she was real cute and nice kid, so we dated a little bit, nothing serious. But if you were busy enough with flying and all of that to where that wasn't a big issue for most people. But one way or the other, on the weekends, we managed to have a good time and unwind a bit and then get ready for Monday morning again.
Now, how many men were you in your class?
I'm going to have to say something just over 50. I wouldn't give you an exact number.
Okay.
But
about 50 or so?
Yeah, around 50. I think we probably started with it from not too far wrong. I think we started with 52 or 53 and ended up with something in the mid-40s,
okay.
44, 45. When it was all over, had several Germans in our class, seven of them, I believe, all probably ahead of us in that before the German government sent them over for, you know, to get the American pilot training, they had all been run through a program in Germany of glider flying, and so they had at least had quite a bit of experience flying gliders solo, and they were pretty bright guys. They hit the ground running. They had no problems. Which brings me to another thing. Back in ROTC, another thing, jumping backwards, there was a program called FIP, which you got into in your junior year, flight indoctrination program, I think is what it stood for. Basically what it was the government paid the juniors who were qualified to go forward to pilot training to go to a local airport, a local flying service, and get a private pilot's license. Mm-hmm. And the idea, of course, was to, at a relatively low cost compared to pilot training, to see if you really, you know, had the interest and or the ability. So I wound up, as did the other guys who were qualified, at Teterboro Airport, which was in New Jersey, but not very far away, over by Newark, not far from Newark Airport, a place called Safe Air, S-A-F-A-I-R, I think, flying service, and was able to get a private pilot's license flying Piper Cubs over there in my junior, and I think it went on over into senior year, as I best recall. So even we, when we went to pilot training, had some flying experience, including solo and some cross-country flying in at least a light airplane. Mm-hmm. We weren't totally green.
Okay. Now, so when you did get to flight school, military flight school, what was the most difficult thing for you?
Most difficult thing for me? I don't recall anything being difficult.
Okay.
The most difficult thing was certainly flying. Well, yeah, you know what the hardest thing for me was, and probably always was, because I don't have a mind for it, was memorizing procedures.
Okay.
Even later, when I was in flying transports and whatnot, I had the devil of a time really getting emergency procedures, particularly, which you're supposed to know just literally by almost by instinct, getting them down. And you know, years and years in the same airplane, I just never was very good at that. So that is one little thing, certainly. But that was about it. I mean, again, in the various flying skills, I wasn't the best in the class, but I don't really feel like I had difficulty in any of them.
Okay.
You know, formation flying, I wasn't the best formation pilot in the class, but I could fly formation and things like that.
Okay.
But yes, memorizing procedures was never good for me. Yeah.
What about celestial navigation training?
None.
Was that later?
Oh, wait a minute. Well, I shouldn't say that so quickly. I think we probably, in our navigation training, had an introduction to celestial, to the point where I think one night we actually did go outdoors with some equipment and do some sighting and some computation.
Okay.
But it was a cursory look. I mean, you know, it's almost as fast as you did it. You said, well, that's interesting. If I ever have to do it, I'll study up on it. But it was almost in one ear and out the other, I would say, because we knew we weren't going to have to do it.
Mm-hmm. What about as a backup, though, an emergency backup?
Well, most of the airplanes weren't equipped for it.
Okay.
And any airplane that was, like the transports that I flew, had, you know, usually two navigators on board. So that,
okay.
And that's what they did.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I used to do it, mm-hmm. now that I think about it, when, you know, became an aircraft commander in the C-133, which is, you know, down the road here a ways. But mm-hmm. I would take a shot every once in a while just for the heck of it. Mm-hmm. But it was not a serious pursuit.
Okay.
And never was. Yeah.
So in flight training, how competitive was it? But as far as for the pilot,
another good question that I hadn't thought about. That's a better question even than I thought. It was very competitive because there were certain personalities being what they are. There were some guys who came into that class, particularly the guys who had more real Air Force background, really intending to compete actively for the best job. Mm. Guys like me, I think, sort of wandered in the door and were a little bit clueless for a while, you know, that there even was a competition in progress.
Mm-hmm.
You figured it out after a while.
Mm-hmm.
And some guys are more and less competitive. I'm not a particularly competitive guy, to be perfectly honest. I just try and do the job and let the chips fall where they may. But the thrust of your question is a very good one because, yes, there were some guys there that very definitely came to pick up all the marbles.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the way that was done was that at the end, when we graduated, a bag of assignments came down, and it was a big hoop-de-doo process, very exciting. I think they made it exciting intentionally, where we had a meeting one morning, and the commander said, okay, guys, here it is. Here's what Air Force has sent us in the way of assignments. And, of course, the big question was how many fighters, you know. Because the guys who were real competitive and the best pilots wanted to get into fighters. I really had no desire to do that. It wasn't like I wouldn't have taken one, but I had no great desire to be in a fighter. But some guys did, and the question was, you know, are there one, are there three, are there five of the 30-some-odd, not counting the Germans, assignments? And then how many of the real bum ones, which, of course, were helicopters? Nobody wanted to fly a helicopter. So the last guy in the class, because that's in 61. Now, today it might be different for various reasons. But, you know, there's a future in flying helicopters on the outside, among other things. But the last guy in the class invariably got the helicopter. So, you know, the last guy, low score, mm-hmm. when they put all three, the academic, the flying, and the officership together,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that was a helicopter. So there was how many helicopters and how many fighters was the first question, and then in between there were various things that were viewed by different people in different lights, transports, B-52s. Nobody wanted to go to SAC because SAC had a terrible reputation of just beating people up physically and mentally. Somewhat physically because of the alerts and the long missions, but more psychologically because of the constant alerts and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So nobody really wanted to go to SAC in a B-52 or anything of that sort, or B-47, which I think was still around then.
Mm-hmm.
The competition was very fierce among the top four or five or six guys in the class because they didn't know how many fighters there were going to be in the bag.
Mm-hmm.
And I, as it turned out, I got transport. That sounds very intense. I would have preferred a transport in the Northeast because it was near home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at McGuire Air Force Base would have been my ideal. As it turned out, there was one, as I think I recall, a C-118, and a guy who was ahead of me in the pecking order took it, and I wound up taking the transport at Travis Air Force Base in California, figuring, well, you know, California sounds pretty good. Never been there.
Mm-hmm.
So I picked that when my turn came. I was about in the middle of the class, as I recall. I think I was number 19. That's just a guess. But so I got to pick you know, it looked like a pretty good deal. It was a transport, which is what I really was preferring to fly, and California sounded good. So I was pretty happy with what I picked.
Okay.
When I picked it, and, of course, subsequently, it turned out okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, so why don't you go ahead and tell...
There are millions of them, but this one story, for example, we were flying around the traffic pattern just doing takeoffs and landings, and there were some Iranian students also, not in our class, but in another class, and there were several of them in the traffic pattern. And one of them, his canopy came unlocked on his airplane, and he called the control. It wasn't really the tower. The tower didn't control us. There was a separate control for the students. I called and said, "What do I do?" And the controller on the ground said, "Land as soon as possible."
Mm-hmm.
And this guy, well, the long and the short of it is that we're sitting there, and we're all hearing this because we're all on the same frequency. And
mm-hmm.
after a while, the guy doesn't appear on final approach, and he's not landing. And so the tower guy says, you know, calls him once or twice, no answer. And then he's calling all of us and saying, "Has anybody seen him? Did anybody spot him?"
Mm-hmm.
And we're all saying, "No, we don't see him out here anywhere." And finally, one guy pipes up and says, "Uh-oh, I think I found him." And the tower says, "Well, where is he?" And he says, "He's down below me." And the guy says, "Well, you know, thinking a couple hundred feet or 500 feet, how far below?" "Well, he's on the ground." And what the guy had done, literally, is pulled the power back on the airplane, landed it straight in the head in the field.
That's what he was told to do.
That's the
cut. Oh, wow.
But, again, you know, if you gave me a couple of beers and we had all night, I mean, there are, you know, like, oh, yeah. As you well know, you've done this. I mean, there are hundreds of these stories, and they're almost all true.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, yeah, I think you're right. Probably a good place to stop.
All right, let me go ahead and do this officially real quick. This will end the first interview.
Okay.
This is Steve Maxer continuing the interview with Mr. Mike Maria. This is the 12th of December, year 2000, at approximately 8:45 Lubbock time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Maria is in Palm Harbor, Florida. All right, sir, would you please begin today's discussion with, go ahead and talk about your transition from pilot training to your first duty assignment, which was to be a C-133 pilot in Travis Air Force Base.
Yeah, okay. Left Craig Air Force Base in October of 1962 upon graduation, and after having, as I discussed in the last interview, after having selected a C-133B transport airplane at Travis Air Force Base in California as my assignment, and en route to Travis, driving by myself, stopped off at Stead Air Force Base near Reno, Nevada, for the Air Force Survival School, which was located there. And as I recall, that was about a three-week process, a lot of academics, various aspects of survival in various environments, medical, how to live off the land, navigation in the woods, those kinds of things. Very interesting school, very enjoyable. Also went through a mock prisoner of war camp while we were there. I think that was about a three-day affair. Again, extremely realistic, just short of physical beating, a lot of verbal abuse, a lot of difficult physical conditions, cold, wet, gloomy, some introduction to I won't say torture techniques, that would be too strong, but torment techniques, being stuck in little boxes for hours on end and things like that. Excellent, excellent training. The prisoner of war experience culminated in a staged escape, where we all escaped into the mountains and then had to make a 3 or 4 day trek from the prisoner of war camp to a place that we had been designated to rendezvous. So I spent 4 days in the mountains making my way across the Sierras and thoroughly enjoyed that because I had always enjoyed the outdoors in the mountains, and it was a some people a grim experience. It was just like a little mini vacation for me, wandering in the hills until we finally got to the rendezvous point, and that was the end of the school. The only other significant thing about that school was that it happened to be occurring at the same time as the Cuban Missile Crisis, and we were so isolated at the school and so intensely involved in our training that we literally missed the whole thing. We got there before it started, graduated after it ended, and really had best of my knowledge, weren't even aware it was happening, which is really something kind of strange when you look back on it. But true. In any case, went from Stead, just a short drive, a few hours, to my first assignment at Travis Air Force Base, and went through the normal checking in and reporting procedures. I was assigned a BOQ room, again in a barracks very similar to the one that we had at pilot training, a long, thin building typically with a whole bunch of doors, and was assigned an apartment with a roommate, a fellow by the name of Carter Neal, went by Chris. He was a navigator in another squadron at Travis, C-124 squadron. And strangely enough, I met Chris not too many weeks ago now at a Forward Air Controller Union reunion at Fort Walton Beach. And we had a good time together, but that's way down the line for this story. In any case, reported to the C-133 squadron and began my training there. There was no transport training school in the Air Force at the time. You went from pilot training, which was basically fighter jets, to your unit, and then you were trained at the unit. So my first experience in a four-engine transport was when I first climbed into one and strapped it on and started listening to the instructor. But adapted to it reasonably well in fairly short order, and started my career, which many, many years in that aircraft, starting out at the bottom level, which was as a second pilot, the levels being starting at the top, flight examiner, instructor pilot, aircraft commander, first pilot, and second pilot. So the second pilot was the green bean, the new guy. And all it meant was that there were certain restrictions on what you could and couldn't do, when you could take off and land the airplane, under whose supervision, and things of that sort. Mm-hmm. But it was a way of working your way into the airplane and developing skills and experience. So for my first 4 years at Travis, pardon me, I did just that. Most of our missions from 62 to 66 were out into the Pacific from Travis, a typical mission: Honolulu, Wake Island, Guam, Clark Air Base in the Philippines, perhaps into Thailand, perhaps into Vietnam in the, well, not so much later days. I think my first trip to Vietnam was actually in early 63, when the situation was very different than it became later. And then coming out of Southeast Asia, we would have gone normally up to Kadena Air Base in Okinawa or Tachikawa Air Base in Japan, and then on home via Midway Island and into Travis again, a trip that theoretically should have taken 6 or 7 days, but because of the maintenance, mechanical, let's say, inadequacies of the C-133, frequently took 2 weeks or more. Again, I was a bachelor, didn't care. Matter of fact, just as soon have been out in the Pacific flying and seeing the sights as being back in California. Let's see, somewhere in about 1964, what happened? There was a situation where the airlines were beginning to transition very rapidly from propeller-driven airplanes to jets, particularly the Boeing 707. And for that reason, they were looking for transport pilots, four-engine qualified pilots. Many, many, many of the guys in my squadron, which, by the way, was the 84th Air Transport Squadron, ATS, were completing their first four-year commitment from pilot training and were getting out of the service to take those opportunities with the airlines. I was approaching my 4 years, wasn't quite there yet, and in any case really had decided that I didn't want to fly New York to Kansas City for the rest of my life and would prefer an Air Force career, so I wasn't really interested in getting out. The point of making that point is that I was approached by my squadron operations officer to go to squadron officer school, which is the first of three formal Air Force schools that are conducted to sort of, we called it re-bluing, just get you up to speed on the latest philosophies and processes and programs in the Air Force, just professional development kind of a school. I was not eligible. I was too junior even to go to that first school, but no one else in the squadron was taking the slot that came down for the school because they were all planning on getting out. So I was asked if I'd like to go, and I said yes and actually went on a waiver because I was, again, too junior. Great school at Maxwell Air Force Base in Alabama, run on a seminar basis, so I think about a dozen guys in each seminar got to be very close. Again, lots of athletics, lots of parties, lots of good academics, speaking skills, reading and writing skills, planning exercises, leadership development exercises, little scenarios that they threw at us to see how we reacted. Just a great school, and long and the short of it is that when I graduated from that school, I think about 3 months later, it's much, much shorter now, I think, but it, back then it was about a three-month TDY, was pretty well fired up, and the Vietnam War was starting to accelerate a little bit, at least. And so the long and the short of that is when I got home to Travis, not too long afterwards, I volunteered to go to Vietnam. This would have been, I guess, in best I remember, mid-65, I suppose, maybe even spring of 65. I guess I should have a better handle on that date, but I don't right off the top of my head. Somewhere in spring of 65, mm-hmm. I think. And it wasn't too long after that that an assignment came down. Mm-hmm. You know, assigning me to Vietnam, say, let's say, late summer, perhaps, of 65. The assignment orders said that I was to report, that I was going to be flying an airplane called an 01. And kind of amusing story, I thought to myself, gee, that's interesting. Never heard of an 01, of course. Okay. And so I thought, wow, I have volunteered for C-123s, transports, figuring my skills would translate most directly there, and I thought that there was actually a typo in the message and that I had been assigned to A-1s, which are old Douglas fighter bombers from the Second World War era, but which were being used to good effect in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And but I found out that, no, there really was an O-1, mm-hmm. and that's what I was going to fly. So in the course of time, you know, transitioning from the receipt of orders to the report date, finally left Travis late in 65 and reported to Hurlburt Field in near Fort Walton Beach in Florida, mm-hmm. for training in the O-1, a little more than the airplane, actually training in the O-1, training in counterinsurgency warfare. Right. The Coin School was there, counterinsurgency school was there, training in close air support procedures, so the whole package of what we were going to have to anticipate in Vietnam was being presented to us there at Hurlburt.
Okay.
Go ahead, Steve. Yeah.
Yeah. Before we get too deeply into the training you receive at Travis,
I
wanted to ask you a couple of questions about
sure.
the training earlier. Now, the survival training you received prior to going to Travis.
Yeah.
At the time, did you find it to be effective?
Yeah, it was tremendous. As I said, extremely realistic. Of course, it had, just as a matter of interest, even though I was going to Vietnam, it had a SAC focus to it. It was primarily designed for SAC bomber crews in anticipation of, as we know today, and of course I think back then it was probably a big secret, but a lot of their missions were one way.
Yes, sir.
They were going to go into Russia, they were going to drop something, and they were going to bail out or crash land, and so... Or they were going to get shot down, you know, in one place or another. So the focus really was on a SAC kind of a survival thing, being shot down in European-style terrain, having to deal with Western European kinds of people, maybe winding up in a Russian or Eastern European prisoner of war camp and that sort of thing. But to answer your question directly, yeah, I thought they did a terrific job there. The instructors were top-notch. The philosophy that they taught under was great. I thought an interesting story. The commandant, whose name is probably in the history book somewhere, but I don't remember, was a Air Force colonel who had actually been shot down in Korea and had crawled out of North Vietnam to South Vietnam, some 100, 150, 200 miles. It's an amazing trek. had lost both his feet to frostbite, and he walked. If you didn't know it, you'd never notice, but he walked without any cane or anything on two wooden feet that he sort of swung on hinges. The only way you could tell is he had an odd gait because he had to swing the foot back and forth every time he took a step. Mm-hmm. But just an amazing guy, and a lot of the instructors were similar. A lot of the enlisted men were like, you know, mountain men, guys from West Virginia and Tennessee and whatnot that really knew the outdoors and whatnot. But everything considered, unarmed combat, we had like the Air Force karate champion was assigned here. I remember a young black fella, a very pleasant guy, but a really good instructor, and his staff were the unarmed combat instructors. So everything was just first rate. Mm-hmm. At least in my, then and even to this day, my recollection is that it was just a terrific school, yeah.
And how about the training you received just prior to getting your orders in terms of the staff training that you received at the school?
SOS, very good. A lot of fun. As I said, it was seminar, so we got to be very tight with one another. A lot of the guys were married and the wives were there, so it seemed like there was a party every night somewhere after class. Athletics were very big. We played a couple of Air Force-invented games. One was called Flickerball. It was kind of a soccer-basketball combination, which I don't know if they still play it or not. And soccer, basketball, football, all three rules mixed together in this game, this field game. We played a lot of regular soccer, a lot of softball. There was a program called something 10. I can't think of the name of it. It was kind of a obstacle course, a really complicated obstacle course brain game thing. You know, you'd show up somewhere with a ladder and a coil of rope, and then your task would be to accomplish something, get across a stream, which appeared to be impossible with those two tools. But we put our heads together and figured out how to do it. And I guess that brings the point up that a lot of it was teaching cooperation, working together. But again, first-class seminar leaders, a great curriculum, tremendous guest speaker program, all top-notch people. You want to talk personnel, if we were studying the personnel system, we got the chief of Air Force personnel would fly down and give us a two-hour blurb and 2 hours of questions and answers in what we called the Big Blue Bedroom, which was a big blue auditorium. But yeah, terrific. And again, it fired me up enough to where when I got home, I volunteered to go to Vietnam. So I guess they did their job pretty well.
And the training you received about 3.5-4 years previously, survival training, that is.
Yeah.
Did you find that again? The emphasis seemed to be SAC, or was it TAC, or a good mix?
It was SAC. But again, I never had to use it, so I was never able to, make, thank God, a field evaluation of my training.
Right.
But my impression was certainly that it certainly would have, both in terms of real knowledge and in terms of survival attitudes, would have certainly been useful had I had to use it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But in the squadron officer school, it was again a SAC emphasis?
No. The whole Air Force. We'd have SAC week, and then we'd have TAC week, and then we'd have Air Training Command week, where we studied each of those.
Interesting.
Yeah. No, it was a complete broad brush of the whole Air Force. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, when you received your orders, to go to Vietnam.
Yeah.
What did you think? Were you happy?
Oh yeah. I certainly was. I was curious at the same time as to what the 01 training was and the job was going to be like. But I wanted to go, and I think the fact that I was going into an airplane other than a transport probably was exciting to me, because I knew that the transport job relatively was going to be benign, although some of the 123 guys flying Ranch Hand, the aerial defoliation missions, and flying support missions later into places like On K certainly wouldn't have said it was benign.
Right.
But generally, particularly in those days, it was going to the larger airfields and simply hauling people and cargo. So it looked like it was going to be a more exciting job, which again, for a 25-year-old young guy, was fine. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had no apprehension or anything. I just really wanted to go see what it was.
Right. What did your family think?
Well, we discussed that a little bit the last time. Obviously apprehensive. My dad, particularly, having been associated with the Navy, and seeing, you know, directly some operational stuff on aircraft carriers, was very concerned. He had also, you know, as I mentioned last time, worked at the Navy Yard in Brooklyn there during the Second World War, and of course the stories coming back from the war and films and all of that sort of thing weren't that far away in his mind. So yeah, he was quite concerned, and my mom too.
Yeah.
But you know, I was going to do it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And to, this may not be the time. It may be a little premature, but as long as we're on it, I actually, you know, downplayed the whole thing considerably in letters home and all of that sort of thing. You don't have to tell them everything.
Absolutely. And then that's certainly something that's consistent with a lot of veterans.
Right.
Okay. Now, you said you had you weren't sure at first when you received your orders that they said that you're going to be flying at 01.
Yeah.
You thought maybe it was a typo or something.
Yeah.
What went through your mind when you finally learned that, yes, this was aircraft, it was.
No problem. Yeah, no problem. It sounded very interesting.
Okay.
I was getting out of airlift into tactical operations,
yes.
And both from just a purely interest point of view and from a career point of view, where diversity has always been considered positive, mm-hmm. you know, it looked like a good idea to me. So,
okay. So
I was quite pleased, yeah.
You weren't at all concerned that, you know, here you're going from a nice, good-sized aircraft, multi-engine, to single-prop, slow, low flyer?
No, again, because remember I had also said that during college they had run us through that FIP program.
Yes.
And I had a private pilot's license, actually. Matter of fact, by then it was probably upgraded to commercial.
Okay.
In small airplanes, and occasionally had been flying small airplanes right out of the Aero Club there at Travis. So I was very comfortable in a light airplane,
mm-hmm.
And even what we call a tail dragger, you know, the older style with a tail wheel, which are a little more difficult to control on the ground. But that was all I had flown, so I was perfectly happy with that.
Okay.
Yeah, and so got happier as I went through the training at Hurlburt because it was really exciting.
And so why don't we talk about that? What mm-hmm. did you? What were the most important things that you thought they covered at Hurlburt when you went through the counterinsurgency and the flying training?
Yeah. Well, the counterinsurgency thing, probably the least interesting, because I think I'd probably had enough of it by then, one place and another, was the, you know, sort of the political underpinnings of counterinsurgency and guerrilla warfare and all of that. I'd had a lot of that at squadron officer school, and I was getting pretty tired of the, you know, guerrilla war philosophy and all of that. Not that it wasn't valid, but just that had it, you know, I'd heard it all. But the procedural things that they taught, the methods used by fighter pilots, their limitations, their capabilities, the limitations and capabilities of the varieties of ordnance that we were going to use, all extremely important, because I was basically you know, clueless about those kinds of things. So that was very important that we be taught, you know, that a fighter can't necessarily drop a bomb from a certain altitude at a certain glide angle. They have parameters that they have to meet. I guess I sort of knew that, but it was certainly hammered home at the school.
A real quick question about that. Did you find that the fighter capabilities and the bomber capabilities were more restrictive than you initially thought, or less restrictive?
More. I thought, I guess naively by that time, that fighters just almost could do anything, you
mm-hmm,
know,
mm-hmm.
And it just isn't the case. It's not close, actually, mm-hmm. Both in terms of weather and speeds and angles and mm-hmm. time that they need to get set up to do various things and fuel considerations, all kinds of things that had never really entered my head because they didn't have to, now certainly did,
mm-hmm.
because I had to be sensitive to all of those things if I was going to employ them correctly. So the school was very good in that regard. We did get a couple of rides, believe it or not, in A1s, again, because they were also training there. My first ride in a real fighter with real guns and real bombs was in those couple of rides we took in the A1s, again, to get a feel for what it was really like for those guys to have to deliver ordnance. So that was both fun and instructive at the same time. And I guess we got three or four rides each with A1s out on the gunnery range
okay.
there at Hurlburt.
Mm-hmm.
But that's that and some very, very basic engineering and checklist kind of training regarding the O-1 were the essence of our ground training. I mean, the O-1 was so simple to fly that, you know, it basically just had a, you know, a few hours for most of us, and we were there.
Could you elaborate on what you mean by engineering training?
Oh, just, you know, how the airplane operates, you know, what kind of an engine it's got, and where the fuel sump is, and where the oil pan is, and that sort of thing. You know, how to change spark plugs if you have to. Very basic stuff on that airplane, obviously. The flying side, if you want to hop to that, was again in a way simple and in a way not. Basically, we flew for a few hours, most of us, with an instructor just to get them comfortable that we can handle the airplane. And then generally, our training after that was solo in and around the Eglin-Hurlburt complex, where there are any number of auxiliary airfields that you can go practice landings and takeoffs at, or and ranges where you could practice shooting rockets and throwing smoke grenades, which were our two primary marking tools. Fly as low as you wanted to, which was kind of fun. They had, as I think I mentioned in that written bit that I sent to you, they had set up on the ranges various things that you were, you know, expected to go out and try and find, you know, trucks hidden under trees and little buildings and foxhole complexes and whatnot, just to train your eye, I think, to start looking for those kinds of things, because that was a big part of the job once you got to Vietnam. So,
and this was part of your VR training.
VR training, exactly, visual reconnaissance VR training. I it's funny, I noticed on one of my flights, for example, I was looking at my Form 5, which, you know, is Air Force is a flying record, the actual record of all of your flying missions and time and all of that sort of thing. And I was looking at Hurlburt, and one day, I think in a six-hour flying day, I logged 46 landings, believe it or not. So we were really practicing pretty hard, the takeoffs and landings, to get our skills down. And it was good that we did, because over there the conditions were quite primitive in some places, and you really had to know what the heck you were doing with the airplane.
Yes, sir.
And what it would and wouldn't do.
And just to make sure, you also received training at this point in firing the FFAR and...
Right. Yeah, a little bit of training, which again was pretty rudimentary. You very quickly... People use different techniques. A little grease... there were no gun sight on the airplane. A little grease pencil X on the windshield was as good a sight as any, although actually, depending on speed and angle, the X wasn't always in the right place. What you really learned after a while was that if the target wasn't moving on your windscreen, in other words, it wasn't going left, right, up, or down, then you were basically going right at it. And if you were going right at it and you fired your rocket, it would usually hit quite close, within, hard to say, but say 20 yards or so, would have been a decent shot under most conditions. That's, you know, we learned that very rapidly, and then it was just a matter of practice until you got very comfortable with it and could do it very quickly. In other words, snap the airplane from one heading to another, maybe change altitude very rapidly, but still control the airplane so that you were on target and the rocket went where it was supposed to. Harder, probably, was actually learning to throw the smoke grenades, which we literally just held out the window and pulled the pin on and then dropped, but to try and control a smoke grenade from nominally at least 1,500 feet and have it fall very close to a target on the ground took a little more learning. So we probably actually spent more time trying to get that down than actually firing the rockets, which, again, sort of came easy after a while. Go ahead.
How about Skippy bombs?
Meaning what?
The Skippy jars.
They certainly didn't. They didn't encourage that at the school. That was a trick we learned in Vietnam. No, that was not taught there. Skippy jars was a very dangerous thing. Depending on how you did it was dangerous in any case. But if you actually pulled the pin and put the grenade in a jar and then put the lid on and carried those in your airplane, if you ever took a bullet, that broke the Skippy jar, you had, you know, depending on the fuse, 3 to 5 seconds to say your prayers, and then it was going to explode in the cockpit. If you did it the smarter way, not necessarily smart, but smarter, you held the jar outside the airplane like a smoke grenade, then pulled the pin, then screwed the lid on, and then dropped it without ever bringing it inboard of the airplane once the pin was out. It worked. It could be somewhat effective, but, you know, the effective burst range of a hand grenade is 25 yards or so. So, again, you had to get awful close to do some damage with it. I don't recall that I ever did it, to be honest with you. I had other weapons which I used over there which I found more effective than Skippy jars.
Just out of curiosity, did you ever hear of anybody having an accident like that you described?
No, not literally. It probably happened, but I don't have a story where I could actually say I actually heard of somebody who either kicked one over or stepped on it or had a bullet break it. Someone probably in the course of time did, but not any direct knowledge.
Okay. Was there anything else that was covered that you found helpful when you got to Southeast Asia?
The only thing I think, and it's important, is that they loosened up on the rules quite a bit. Basically, they said, look, you guys are going into a combat environment. It's time to forget Air Force Regulation 6016, which is the basic flying regulation for the whole Air Force, basic philosophy on flying and flying safety. And so they said, look, you want to fly at 50 feet, fly at 50 feet. You know, you want to fly the airplane slow, fly it slow. You want to go down to Fort Walton Beach and land it on the beach? Go ahead. You may have to do that someday, and better you try it here than when you have to. So,
wow.
So we did. I made several landings on not at the public beaches, but there's a lot of beach along the Outer Barrier Islands in that area, say between Pensacola and probably Panama City. And a lot of it is actually it's inaccessible to the public because there were Air Force installations out there, mainly radar, either looking at Cuba or watching the fighter training area, which was out over the water, and, you know, kind of scoring and keeping track of things in the big training area, the jet fighter training area out over the Gulf. So you could pick a piece of beach and fly down it, you know, just above it, and kind of assess the hardness of the sand. You always wanted to, if you tried this, you got to land close to the water because the sand is harder there because it's been wet. And, you know, get the airplane real slow and see what you can do with it. And those kinds of things were, I guess, I won't say officially encouraged, but people certainly said, you know, you need to get the feel for the airplane. You need to, you know, see what your own limitations are, and here's the place to do it. Those kinds of thoughts. And so we did. out in the range where there was nobody around, you could try landings on you know, little short dirt airfields and just see how low you could get the airplane and how slow before you stalled it, and you know, what kind of a landing roll you could achieve, and, you know, how short a landing roll you might achieve if you really pushed the airplane a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And we found out things that came in very handy later.
Were there
at least
any,
I did.
Were there any incidents where, you know, damage to aircraft?
No, not in my class, not that I can recall. A lot of guys who hadn't flown tail drag or airplanes before were ground looping them, which is are you familiar with a ground loop? You know what it is?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, guys were ground looping the airplanes with pretty good regularity until they got the hang of it. And the worst, usually the worst you do in a bad ground loop is you might drag a wingtip and scratch it up a little bit. It's more embarrassing than anything else. But,
was that a washout offense?
Or? No. They weren't washing anybody out at that stage. I mean, you had pilots with 4 to 5, 6 years under their belt or more in some cases going through this training. And you know, it was just a matter of, okay, you know, you've never flown one of these. You got to learn to really keep the rudders wiggling to keep the airplane straight, and once you learn that, you're okay.
Okay. And I guess when you left Hurlburt to go to Vietnam, did you feel like you were prepared?
Yes. I you know, you're not sure because you know you're going into combat, you know you're going to a war, you knew you were going to one that was of a different style than we had really ever fought before, and that it was accelerating in intensity fairly rapidly by, say, early 66, which is when I got there. So healthy apprehension, I would say. Not, I wasn't afraid, but I was certainly, you might say, keyed up would be a better phrase. Really anxious to see what it was like, and aware at least that this was a no fooling around thing. You know, that you were going to have to pay attention and not make any mistakes, because you know, any mistakes you made that were unnecessary were just going to increase the odds in the wrong direction. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think healthy respect for the situation, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when you got there, after you started your operational flying,
yeah,
was there anything that you came to wish that they had covered better at Hurlburt?
Think about that a minute. I never thought about that. Not really. No, I guess not. I guess it was very different. They couldn't, I guess what I'm trying to say, they could not fully duplicate the situation, but they did the best they could. Particularly, I guess the thing that struck me was once you got there and got to your assignment location, the feeling of being alone and on your own was intense. I mean, you were it. There was no instructor to turn to, no classmates, no squadron ops officer who was older and more experienced, no instructors. You could say, hey, I'm not working this out too well. How about you give me a ride and show me how to do it? You were alone, and that, I guess, was my real first impression. And yet, how they could have prepared you for that, except for maybe mentioning you're going to feel this. I don't know how they could have prepared you for that. But that was distinctly the feeling was, wow, you know, here I am, you know, what I got, what I brought with me in terms of training and just experience is what's going to get me through this, because I'm on my own.
Well, so when you got there, I guess we should probably discuss the trip over.
Trip over? Yeah, we can. Yeah. I'm not sure I remember it.
okay. What happened when you finished your training?
Very quickly after training, you know, I was there for Christmas of 65, and I honestly do not recall if I zipped up to New York to see my family one last time or not. I'm sure that if I could, I did, but I don't remember. And in any case, either from Hurlburt or from New York, I went back to Travis. By then, let's see, where was I? I had actually moved twice in those 4 years. I left the base, which most guys did when they could, because the living conditions were better downtown in a nice apartment. I got me a roommate named Fred Sanford, who was a pilot in my squadron, and Fred and I roomed together in an apartment down in Fairfield, which is the other town that's adjacent to Travis, for quite a while. Then Fred got married, and I moved back to Vacaville with a couple of guys from the squadron in a house, a real house that one of the guys had bought, and then he was just financing it basically by having two or three other guys move in. But we were all pilots in the same squadron. I went back there and stayed there for a few days, I guess, and sort of put my affairs in order. Again, as I indicated in my written narrative, I was a pretty avid reader at the time, and I stuck a box of mostly spy novels, Helen McInnes and Eric Ambler and James Bond and a million others, in an enormous box, actually a console television had come in it, and I stuck them up in the attic, and I think they're still there. I never did retrieve them, but I put my affairs in order for two or three days and then basically caught my flight right out of Travis again. Carrying the absolute minimum of a couple of light bags of underwear and shaving kit and a couple of uniforms and that much else over there. And Transport, Continental or Braniff or one of those, who were all operating contract airlift out of Travis by those days, simply moving troops. And probably made a stop or two, Honolulu, Guam. But Absolutely, you know, a lost trip in my mind. It's totally uneventful. Just got there in the course of time, mm-hmm. and that was that.
Well, you mentioned reading material earlier. In your, I guess you enjoy spy novels.
I did then. My tastes have changed slightly since. I'm into now science fiction, good stuff, and fantasy, science fantasy, you know, The Hobbit, things like that, and a good, what they call a good English country house mystery, you know, a good Agatha Christie or something like that. And I still read an enormous amount. I probably still read a book a week or more, and back in those days I was probably reading two or three a week.
Wow.
Yeah, so I've read a lot of books in my time.
As you were getting ready to go to Vietnam, did you expand your reading into areas concerning Vietnam?
No, I didn't at all. I think I felt that the training had, you know, had prepared me. Between, again, SOS and Hurlburt itself, I have to believe that I thought I knew everything there was to know, in the sense that everything that was out there had been presented to me at some point in the recent past. So I didn't do anything additional, didn't grab a language book or anything like that, and turned out I didn't need it. So.
Okay.
Yeah. I think somewhere, now that you mention it, either at Travis as we got on the airplane, probably that's the case, they gave us, it was a little pamphlet-type book. It was probably 4 inches by 4 inches or 3 by 5 or something like that, and maybe a quarter of an inch thick, and it was a guide to Vietnam, basic. In fact, the Air Force, I think, or the government, probably the Air Force, back in those days, had a whole series of these. If you were going overseas, you could get one on Turkey or Germany or wherever you happen to be going. A little bit of the history and customs and how to behave, and I guess a very basic pointy-talkie kind of a thing in the back with language. So I do remember that, because the front cover of it had a picture of a Vietnamese peasant woman with the pointed straw hat working in a field. That was what was on the cover. Funny, the things you do remember when you're prompted by questions. Again, you know, I could talk any one of these phases. I could probably talk to you for 3 weeks on any one of them, if you know, depending on details and whatnot. But yes, I do remember that little book. So I guess I read that on the airplane on the way over.
Now, what did you think was going on in Vietnam when you left?
When I left, what did I think was going on in Vietnam? I thought it was basically a civil war, that there was a civil war in progress with aid on one side from the North Vietnamese, communist government. And I think in 1966, that's probably pretty close to accurate. I wasn't totally naive because I had been flying in there in the 133, as I hinted, since 63, very early 63. And I knew that the government that we were supporting was in many ways corrupt, very typical of Asian, what shall we say, Asian, at least mainland Asian historical government approaches, which, again, in my little notes, I said there were, you know, the peasants were just trying to bring in a crop of rice and watching, you know, one side romp across their farm from south to north and the other side romp across their farm from north to south and trampling the rice, and that had probably historically been the lot of the Asian peasant, whether it's Chinese or Burmese or Vietnamese or Cambodian, since forever. The government was in the hands of a very wealthy, elite, previously French-supported ruling class. Basically, not quite a monarchy, I guess an oligarchy is closer, a feudal system. The province chiefs, not province chiefs, what the heck am I trying to say, not provinces, well, the core areas, First Corps, Second Corps, Third Corps, and Fourth Corps,
yes,
were run by a corps commander who basically operated like a Chinese warlord. He owned that area, and as long as he made the appropriate physical and financial bows to the government in Saigon, he was allowed to do what he wanted pretty much in his area. And then within his area, he had province chiefs, and they were, you know, the petty warlords, very medieval, feudal kind of a system almost. And I knew that. I don't think it bothered me much. I thought that, again, in 60, it's you have to understand the political philosophies. Korean War wasn't, it was just barely 10 years over. In fact, was never over and still isn't over, technically. The idea of the domino principle and the communism attempting to dominate the world step by step was very real in our minds, and we believed it. I think it's true that that was the philosophy. They just never were able to execute it. So I knew, you know, or at least believed that I was going into a situation that where the effort was probably worth it, even if the individuals that we were going to save weren't. How's that sound? at least at the top. You know, the peasants are always peasants, and they're always worth saving, but, you know, the best thing you can do for them is get away or go away.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's what you thought before you left.
Yeah.
Did your opinion change over time, or did
I actually think it got better as I by the time I left, I think my opinion was better all the way around. I had a better opinion of the Vietnamese who I had met at every level. I think it's fair to say that after a couple of coups, the leadership that was in place when I left in Vietnam was a better leadership than the one that was there when I got there, probably not by great orders of magnitude, but I think they were more interested in actually fighting a war than they were in lining their pockets. Not entirely, but let's say more. The officers, the Vietnamese officers and enlisted men who I knew were, I found, very dedicated soldiers and a lot better fighters than most people gave them credit for. But in any case, considering the fact that some of them had been at it, you know, for their entire life with the French, Japanese, us, and God knows who else, so I thought I had a much higher opinion of them. The Vietnamese people, the ordinary people, I liked quite a bit. They were, like most people, just decent people. You know, the farmers that I ran into, and even people in Saigon that shop people, and you know, people in restaurants and bars and whatnot, were, you know, all decent people. So I think my opinion of the people certainly was higher than when I got there. My opinion of the war at that point, I think I thought we were winning and could win, but again, that was February of 67, before the, you know, the big problems that came starting with Tet of 68 and then running on it to 70 and beyond. I guess the truth of it, now that you mention it and you think about it, is I think most of us had a much lower opinion of our leadership at home than we did the people in Vietnam. I think we thought our leadership were weak and wimpy and overly cautious and nervous and overly involved in the war fighting effort. People like McNamara and whatnot, and even Lyndon Johnson. You know, I don't think we had then, nor do I today, have much of an opinion of them, at least in regard to how the war was prosecuted.
Oh, that's interesting. What at the time, as you were getting ready to go over to Vietnam?
Yeah.
You know, a couple of important events domestically as well, with a lot of civil rights activism and a lot of,
right.
And of course, the assassination of President Kennedy.
Yeah.
How did those events affect you?
Assassination of Kennedy didn't affect me much at all, simply because I was so busy at the time, just, you know, trying to, you know, a whole new life for me. I mean, he was assassinated somewhere in 63, wasn't it?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, so October, wasn't it? I don't know.
November.
Yeah, so I was, you know, fairly new in the airplane, new in terms of making a real paycheck and running my own life, I guess, and those sorts of things. It, you know, obviously affected me like it affected anybody else, but not in any real sense, more emotionally than in any real sense. And life goes on, you know. And it didn't have much of an effect. The civil rights thing, I think at that point, was still fairly low key. The hippies down in San Francisco were more amusing than they were dangerous. That's too strong is why I'm hesitating to say it, but all you, the moral decadence that I think was to come in later years that began in the 60s wasn't all that apparent at the time. I think now back on the movies of the 60s, they were kind of be cute immoral, you know, the mini skirts and the sort of innuendo kind of humor that was starting to occur in the movies and whatnot was still sort of amusing. It hadn't picked up a true, you know, decadent sort of a nature to it that I think started to occur as the war became less popular, maybe 68, 69, 70. The hippie movement became a more of an angry anti-war, anti-country movement. You had the Chicago riots, the Chicago Convention riots. You had people like McGovern running for president, which started to polarize the country. Not that it's his fault. He thought the way he thought. But a real polarity in the country started to arise, I think, back in the, you know, just slightly after my Vietnam time. I think you're seeing it this morning as we speak. You know, the country has, since those days, let's say if you look very broadly from the late 50s where we had our differences but we were one country, to today where we have our differences and we really aren't one country anymore, we're very polarized. I think that occurred through the 60s, and Vietnam was certainly a strong element in, encouraging isn't quite the right word, but facilitating that polarization. It may have even been the focal element that, I don't know, historians will figure that out. But anyway, where were we? I know I drifted on you.
No, that was great.
The answer is that I wasn't much affected by any of that, I guess is what you were looking for, and that's the answer. I knew it was going on. It didn't look all that dangerous or virulent at the time. I had my own things to do, and it was not a problem. Yeah, for me at least.
Well, what led you to, you made the statement about McNamara and Johnson. Would you describe a little bit more in detail what you thought about their policies
from the
Gulf of Tonkin in 64 up to the time you were leaving for Vietnam?
No, I can't, because my opinions of them really are based on post-Vietnam, post my time. In other words, when I was back flying the 133, and the war was still continuing, and I could see it going toward failure. And of course, I felt like I had contributed, and I knew guys had contributed a lot more than I did, and these guys were letting those contributions and efforts go down the drain. So while I was there, I was essentially content with the political situation, not sure I thought about it much, because I thought we were working in the right direction, we were building up, we were fighting. We seem to be intent on winning, at least until Tet of 68, by which time I'd been home a year, which is another story we'll get to, because by then I was really in Korea for the Pueblo crisis, but that comes later.
Okay.
But so my time in Vietnam, I didn't have those feelings. Those feelings came much later, like in the 70s, I think, when it was obvious that we were not intending to win, that we were looking for a way out, honorable or otherwise, and so that's when the negativism started to come in. That coupled with my opinion, which I still hold, that the political leadership got much too involved in the details of military operations, and that's never good. They can certainly set the stage, and that's their job, and set the tone, but they ought not to be, you know, deciding whether you fire to the left or fire to the right or what. Mm-hmm. And they were doing that, and McNamara was a key architect of that, because he actually believed, I think, that you can run a war on business principles. And, that's idiotic, as history, and even he has admitted, unfortunately, many, many years too late, was an idiotic idea. So.
Well, what did you think about some of the incremental policies, the incremental bombing?
Mistakes, clearly.
But at the time.
Yes, even at the time. But those, again, came after my time. But yes, those are part of those elements that began to raise a level of dismay, at least dismay and disgust with me about the leadership as the subsequent years went on. Incrementalism just doesn't work in a war. You've got to make a leap and get the other guy's attention, because if you go incremental, he's just going to incrementally adapt, which is exactly what the North Vietnamese particularly were able to do.
Yes, sir. Well, you know, we've talked about the political leadership. Mm-hmm. Well, we'll go ahead and shift to the military leadership for a minute. I'm curious, this may be, you know, too far out of the experience you had in Vietnam, but what about the policy that Westmoreland put into place, that is the policy or strategy of attrition? Was that discussed at all amongst you and your fellow pilots? And
no.
Did you agree with that at all? Or?
That really was just, you know, a military translation of the political philosophy that was coming down from Washington. Attrition equals incrementalism. It's the same thing. But no, we didn't discuss it. At that point, we were too busy, you know, with what's the target for today and what's the flight call sign and what kind of ordnance they got on them. And that was the level we were working at. Plus, as I indicated to you, we were so isolated that there really wasn't too many people to talk with. You know, we haven't gotten to that yet, but
no.
I mean, and it's all in the notes that I gave you. But, you know, my first assignment, as best I recall, and again, it's almost eerie because it's surreal and almost like it didn't happen, although I know it did. I know there were a number of Americans at Duc Hoa, which was the first place I went, and yet I only remember one. That was my old roommate, Dave Pinsky. But I think Dave and I were the only two facts there at the time. So, you know, we were busy, and it wasn't a lot of time for political discussion. It was the discussions tended to center more around home kind of stuff. You know, you might talk about sports. You might talk about your family. You might talk about what you're going to do when you go back, those kinds of things. We didn't get into any heavy political discussions over there.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and get to Vietnam then for a little bit. What were your first impressions when you arrived? That is, when you were getting off the plane and you were on Vietnamese soil.
Yeah, okay. Now, understand that we landed at Thanh Sanut, which is the big airport in Saigon.
Yes, sir.
And I had been there many times, so the place was familiar to me. At least it wasn't a shock, which I imagine it would have been to some people.
Mm-hmm.
It was not a shock to me. But even saying that, the feeling that, yeah, okay, I'm really here, and I'm going to be here for a year if I survive, was, you know, it was real. It was like, all right, fooling around is over. This is not a concept anymore. This is reality. I'm here. And I think we all felt that, getting off the airplane. It was hot, even in February, and sticky, which it always was. And especially getting off an air-conditioned airplane, it just about whacks you when you step off the door opens. My recollection of the process is vague, but I think accurate. I think we were simply guided across the ramp a short distance, maybe 100 yards, to some buildings that, again, were very close to the ramp area, reception area, where we were greeted and processed fairly quickly. I think we were issued some a sleeping bag and a few odds and ends the first day, and we were told where the officers' club was and told what we had to do the next day. And we went to a building that basically looked to, my mind says, was like a hangar, big but with no walls and just full of cots, and not cots but bunk beds. And we basically just sort of hung around that first day because they didn't have anything for us, and found a bunk and dumped our stuff and wandered over to the officers' club and had a few drinks to see if you could spot anybody you knew, kind of a thing. And on the airplane going over, I think there were at least one or two guys that were, excuse me, from my Hurlbut class. So we sort of, you know, clustered together, had a couple of drinks and dinner, and wandered around Thanh Sanut, sort of got the lay of the land. Then the next day was in processing, which was a little bit more regimented, shot records, and we were issued some basic gear. I think some firearms were issued at that point, an M16 and a 38 revolver and some ammunition, very small amount, 20, 30 rounds of ammunition. And fatigues, we were issued fatigues, basically told, you know, you can roll up your 1505s, which was the Class B uniform at the time, you know, the tan uniform, and keep them if you want or throw them away. Most guys find they don't use them while they're here. You know, some basic personnel processing, next of kin kind of things. At some point, we were told to select a code word that we were going to use if we were shot down or taken prisoner so that we could verify who we were. I remember mine was Blue Carbuncle, which was a title of one of Sherlock Holmes' short stories. So, you know, if they wanted to really prove it was me, it was supposed to be me, and the safe that thing went into were the only people who knew that word until it became necessary to use it. Some transportation scheduling to get us to our units. Very, very basic, and again, very vague in my mind, as you can tell by the way I'm sort of mumbling. But we were there for, I think, 2 days, or a day and a half, not much more, and I got on a bus at the appointed time and was driven over to Benoit Air Base, which wasn't very far, an hour drive, probably, maybe not even that much. And that was my first look at least part of the real Vietnam, that is to say, a Vietnam outside of a military base, which had always been my experience in the past, even flying in previously, or downtown Saigon being a big city, not quite the same as the boondocks. So we got to see a little bit of the countryside on the way over to Benoit. And that was somewhat of a surprise to me, but not much either, because, again, I'd been flying in Asia for 4 years, and I knew what poor Asia looked like, whether it was Taiwan or, you know, rural Japan or Thailand or whatever. I knew what to expect, you know, dirt roads and open sewers and houses made out of whatever and people who, you know, looked like farmers and didn't wear shoes and that sort of thing. So not a great shock, but interesting, clearly, because this was going to be where we were going to be for a year. So I paid attention in the bus ride on over, and then they dropped me at my unit, which was the 19th TAS, Tactical Air Support Squadron. And the 19th TAS, and I never bothered getting myself too acquainted with the structure because it didn't matter to me. But now, as an aside, as I think you know, I'm at least volunteered to do the 19th TAS portion of this fact book that we're going to try and write as a result of the reunion that you were at. And so I'm going to get more into what was the structure and who was the leadership at different periods of time. But basically, it was just a small building. And the 19th TAS administratively, and I guess to some degree operationally, controlled all the forward air controllers in the 3rd Corps area. And I was going to be in the 3rd Corps area, as it turned out, so that's where they sent me. And indoctrination there, again, was quite brief. I think I only spent one night, maybe two, there at Benoit, again in a transit barracks, very basic sort of a thing. Spent some time at the club, at the bar, had dinner. Ran into, interestingly, one of the guys I had lived with in Vancouver, actually the guy who owned the house that we lived in, Bob Hilvers. Bob was there flying the U-10, which is a kind of a semi-CIA kind of an airplane, a Pilatus, I think the Pilatus Porter, made in Sweden or somewhere in Finland. Sweden, I believe, but he was flying it. Propaganda kind of an airplane. It had loudspeakers on it. It could drop leaflets, did things of that sort. And he came limping down the street because he had taken a couple of pieces of shrapnel during a mortar attack about 3 days before on Benoit. So we talked for a few minutes. He was going someplace, had to be there, and I was going someplace and had to be there. So we only talked a couple of minutes and never saw him again, as it turned out. But the indoctrination there at the 19th TAS was, again, very basic. You know, making sure you had what you needed, the right uniforms, fatigues, the right, you know, the right weapons. All the paperwork had been filled out correctly. You understood where you were going, what you were going to do, and who the boss was and what their function was and that sort of thing. I don't think they even gave me a check flight. I don't recall one. They had airplanes there, but I don't even recall anybody saying, can you just show us if you can fly the airplane? I guess they assumed that. And this was before the days of the in-country fac school, which I'm sure you've heard of,
yes,
about, just before that. So I did not go to that. It wasn't there. Mm-hmm. I think it probably came just months later, but I did not go to that. I just went straight After, you know, we figured out that I wasn't getting anything done at Benoit that needed to be done, they said, well, where you're going is Duquoise. And I said, that's interesting. Tell me where that is. And they showed me on a map. And one morning, either the second or third morning I'd been there, I don't really remember, a Army helicopter came by and picked me up. We went wakata-wakata in the helicopter out to Duquoise, which was... from Benoit, again, about a half-hour plane ride. It couldn't have been any more than that, probably less. More or less straight west from the Saigon-Benoit complex there. Just a little old airfield. Somebody told me that the Japanese had actually built it during the Second World War, but that may or may not be true. In a little town, rice fields and mud, you know, water buffaloes, typical place. With a very small compound where the U.S. advisors, both Army and the FACS, lived for their year out there in company with the leadership of the local Vietnamese military unit, which is going to take some explaining. But before I do that, I think, again, in my written narrative, I said that when the helicopter landed on a little PSP, pierced aluminum planking, I think, ramp that was there by the runway, and the local FAC came out to meet me because he'd been told I was coming, and turned out to be my pilot training roommate, Dave Pinsky, who, by the way, just for interest, Dave turned out to retire as a brigadier general, and I think he was the wing commander of the SR-71 wing at Beale Air Force Base in California when he retired. And again, I saw him at the FAC reunion, so that was nice. But back to the story. So Dave met me, said hi. Nice to see you, and this is what where you're going to be for the next year. And he walked me across the ramp to some new construction. They had just started to kind of try and build this place up a little bit. The runway was being improved, and there were some very nice, newly painted cement block barracks and office buildings and cement sidewalks and all of that sort of thing, and nice, clean trash barrels outside. Actually, quite spiffy for Vietnam. Looked real nice. And my room was nice and clean and linoleum tiles, kind of a floor, and very nice fan, you know, a fan going. Might have even been an air conditioner, but I don't think so. Fan. Nice little mess hall and whatnot. So that was the environment there. The mission basically was to be the forward air controller for Hau Nia, and that's spelled H-A-U, second word, N-G-H-I-A, Hau Nia province, which was where Duquoise was located, and we were to be the FACS for that province and for the Vietnamese, the regiment, as best I understand it, of the 25th Vietnamese Division, which was also responsible for that province. The 25th Division, three regiments, being also responsible for Tay Ninh province, which was the province to the north, and Long An province, which was the province to the south. So that was how it was structured. We were smack in the middle of the Vietnamese structure, in other words. We were not working for Americans. We were not associated with Americans, except a couple of American advisors to that regiment, who also lived at Duquoise. But our boss was the province chief, basically, or at least the man we were there to support and answer to, was the Vietnamese province chief, and the Vietnamese regimental commander there. So that was the story, and basically we did every day, pretty much, sometimes more than once a day, we would go out and fly visual reconnaissance. The terrain was as flat as a board and very swampy in Hau Nia province. Almost no towns. Most of it was free fire, if not all of it was free fire zone. It was on the west side of a river, Vam Co Dong, I believe was what it was called, which means there was a Vam Co Dong and a Vam Co something, and it just means the Vam Co River East and the Vam Co River West. Anyway, it was basically on that river and everything between that river and the Cambodian border, which was the other limit of Hau Nia province, farther to the west, was just a big open swamp, free fire zone with a couple of little towns. Most of them clustered along the river itself. So we went out and did reconnaissance, and more or less, true, with it, with some judgment occasionally, anything that moved out there you shot at. We tried to find VC, very few, if any, NVA out there, just a local Viet Cong, either trying to move through the area or trying to build something in the area or trying to mass a some sort of a force that could harass a town or an outpost of some sort, a village outpost, or what have you. So our job was to basically keep their heads down, I guess, in plain and simple English. That was it, and keep them nervous and eliminate as many of them as we could. And so we did reconnaissance, and when we found targets, we would pre-plan airstrikes through the Direct Air Support Center, also at Benoit. And if we found something moving that we hadn't anticipated, why, we'd try to get an immediate airstrike, again, communicating through our radios, either directly or through the radio at Duquoise to the Direct Air Support Center. Long and the short of it is I wasn't there very long. I was there, I don't really know, but I think about a month and a half, and it's all very weird to me. Again, I know I must have met people other than Pinsky, both Americans and Vietnamese, and I can't put a face or a name on one of them. So I may have been in some sort of emotional shock without really realizing it, although I don't feel like I was. But I sure don't remember much about that place. And what happened then is that a pilot, whose name I have recorded but I don't have in my head, down at the southern province, Long An, city of Tan An, capital of province Long An, fact down there, of whom there were two, got shot one day, took a bullet up through his seat, to be indelicate about it, and was very badly wounded and was sent home and never came back. He didn't die, but he was very badly wounded. So for whatever reason, pipeline or whatnot, I guess they thought they needed to send me down there, they meaning the 19th TAS, and they were going to send somebody else to Duquoise. So I was told one day, jumping an airplane, Pinsky and I, and you're going to go down, Dave's going to take me down to Long An, Tan An, and I was going to be the fact down there for the rest of my career. So we did that, and Dave went back to Duquoise, and I didn't see him again for endless years. But I was met there at another very primitive airstrip. It was really just a wide spot in the road, about 1,000 feet long, with a PAP ramp where they had some 55-gallon fuel drums sandbagged, and we pumped our own fuel with a hand pump and threw a chamois cloth into the airplane. It was that primitive. But I was met by a guy named Pete Bernstein. It's comical in a way. Comical isn't the right word. But both of these guys were Jewish, by the way. And back in those days, there weren't that many Jewish officers in the military or in the Air Force. But Dave was Jewish, and so was Pete. I don't know if that's relevant, but it's interesting. But Pete met me, and we got to be good buddies for, again, only about a month and a half, 2 months. Pete was, like Dave, very aggressive pilot, very good pilot, nice guy to know. We lived and flew together at the town, again, of Tan An, the province of Long An. Airfield, I think, was known as Long An as well. I could be wrong about that. We lived in a slightly different situation. My memory of that is just a tad better than of Duquoise. Mission was essentially the same. Visual reconnaissance, keep their heads down, find them and kill them when you could, basically. But we lived in town, and the town was quite a nice little town for Vietnam. A little rural town, but quite nice. A couple of decent little restaurants. Very primitive, but decent. A river flowing through it, some bridges, a soccer field, quite a nice little place. We lived in a two-story, I think it was two-story, may have been three, house right on the soccer field. And this house was given over to the U.S. Military Advisory Detachment, of which there were, for some reason, more people than there were at Duquoise, probably because the facility was there. So there was an Army colonel in charge of the Army Advisory Detachment to the province chief, who lived in a palace just down to the right at one end of the soccer field. And a whole range of officers advising the province in various fields, logistics and intelligence and whatnot. So there were captains and lieutenants and majors and whatnot. But just two facts, just me and Pete. And we lived in the house. I had a room with an Army guy, and we lived there, I would say, quite comfortably. we had maids and a cook, and we ran our own mess. Somebody went to Saigon once a month or every couple of weeks and hit the commissary and came back with all the essentials, and we made our own meals, or had the cook make them, but, you know, more or less identified what they would be. And I had laundry service, and the rooms were comfortable. Played cards at night, watched movies, just talked, drank again as usual, probably more than we should have. Not to excess, I wouldn't say, because you had to fly every day, but, you know, you sat and had three or four drinks every night, certainly. Talked about this and that, but again, not politics. Talked just about, you know, home and what are you going to do and how was your day and, you know, what's going on in the province, those kinds of things. And let's see. Again, the stories, but a lot of the stories that I remember, Steve, are in that written document I gave you. At least, particularly for Vietnam, I think I took more time to try and remember as much as I could about the kind of the funny or not so funny stories. Mm-hmm. But in any case, maybe we can go ahead.
I was just going to say, sure. Could I ask you just a couple real quick questions?
Absolutely.
Focus on a couple of issues. In your time at Duqua, you mentioned that although it was a brief period, you had a lot of you got a lot of operational experience, a lot of reconnaissance and things like that.
Yeah.
You also mentioned in the written document that you were able to call in a number of different types of fire, artillery, airstrike, and others.
Right.
Did you find what type of fire did you find more effective? Did you not like the fire, particular type of fire?
I didn't care. If I needed to do it, I just, you know, lived with whatever I had available to me at the time.
Okay.
But to answer your question, and it'll come up again probably, the least effective was artillery in most cases. The Vietnamese artillery, and I never controlled, to best of my knowledge, U.S. artillery while I was at Duqua. Okay. They had a few guns, 105 howitzers, located at various more or less secure places, but they weren't bedded in concrete or like a gun really needs to be very accurate. After they fired three or four times, if they jump a foot, that foot of jumping back will equate to several hundred yards on the other end. And so they weren't very accurate. They tried real hard. They were competent people. They just weren't working with the very best of equipment and circumstances. As a matter of fact, I made it a point to visit them. Usually a captain, a Vietnamese captain in charge of a gun position, so that we, you know, just face to face, we knew who we were and who we were talking to. Sometimes that helps, and I could look at the guns and see what their problems were in terms of how much time they took and you know what problems they were fighting and trying to do what I was trying to get them to do, and that was very useful. Primitive maps that they were trying to use and ranging and distances. They just didn't have the skills or the training to be extremely accurate. They tried as best they could. By extremely accurate, I'm talking about hitting within 10, 20 yards with artillery, which is doable. A lot of people don't believe that, but it is doable if you got the right people shooting with the right equipment, namely the U.S. Marine Corps, but that comes later in the story. But artillery was not good, particularly if you were trying to use high explosives against a target. Now, if you used airburst, it was a little better because, you know, if you could burst a shell at a couple hundred, 300, 400 feet in the air and get a spray pattern of shrapnel in that open swamp, you could do some damage. And I learned that and tried to use VT, vicinity timed fuses, whenever I could, just for those kinds of reasons. Also, a shell hitting in the mud by the time it explodes has lost a lot of its power. So artillery at Duqua was not all that useful. Helicopters, almost all flown by U.S. people, when you could get them, provided the target was reasonably soft, were extremely effective, because back in those days, they were all being flown by 18-year-old warrant officers who were crazier than I was, and they would just do anything. And with rockets and machine guns, you know, literally hovering over the target, they were ignoring potential danger, was a very effective weapon, provided you were talking troops in the open or lightly defended targets, things of that sort. or you know, a small wooden bridge that you needed to knock down with rockets. They were very, very good. So I was, aside from the fact that, you know, you had to sort of keep them from killing themselves at times, they were very, very effective. The airplanes ran a range because they were all different. The most accurate, far and away, was the A-1 flown either by a Vietnamese or an American. The Vietnamese A-1 pilots had been flying for years and years and years, and they were just unbelievably good. They knew their country, they knew the terrain, they knew the targets, they knew their weapons, everything. They were just superb. The problem, and they had tremendous endurance. It was a slow, gasoline-fueled airplane that could linger for hours under certain circumstances if you needed them to, and they carried a ton of ordnance. Depending, 110-pound white phosphorus bombs, which was a very effective bomb, as you've seen in the World War II films with the white phosphorus smoke trail, they could carry 48 of them, as I remember. It was an enormous number. So they were very effective. Their only weakness is they had 50 caliber machine guns, a rate of fire very slow, and not as effective as a gun as other guns would were. But all in all, I would say that if I was in a fight, my preferred airplane was the A-1, without a doubt. And I didn't care whether a Vietnamese was flying it or an American. I had no trouble controlling them. Language wasn't a problem. They were good. And they could linger, and they could drop one bomb at a time, and they could see their target because they were slow. They were the best, in my opinion. Right up behind them was the F-100, flown by Americans, usually out of Benoit when we were talking Duquoise and Longhand. I think more experienced pilots. The airplane was designed for air-to-ground operations. It could deliver ordnance, bombs, napalm extremely accurately. And the gun on that airplane was CBUs as well, cluster bomb units, extremely effective. And the gun was very, very effective on that airplane, 20-millimeter cannon, very accurate, at least in the hands of the pilots that I dealt with, that I flew with, or flew. Had fly for me, however you want to look at it. So those were the two best far and away. And I would say that everything else came a poor second. Whether it was F-5s, which were the Scotia Tigers, they were the training, you know, the even today the current advanced pilot training trainer. Quick little airplane, good little airplane, but very light load. F-4, in my opinion, probably the worst airplane for the job. Not really designed for close air support. Not accurate as accurate as the others with any of its ordnance, bombs, napalm, guns, or anything else. Never was crazy about the F-4. A4, that's one we ought to talk about, Navy. The A4s that came off the carrier, Dixie Station, out in the China Sea, were very spotty. My impression was that frequently if you got a flight of four, you'd have three green bean pilots on it who really just didn't have the experience to deliver ordnance accurately. Usually there was one old man in the squadron, and you could tell just by the voice and the control and the accuracy of his delivery which one was which in any flight, even if he wasn't calling himself lead or whatnot. So the A-4 was a very capable airplane, similar to the F-100, in that it was designed for close air support in the Navy, but for the Marine Corps. But the pilots coming off Dixie Station were not always, in my estimation, they were just new. They just weren't experienced. So it was very spotty. Plus, they had some weird ordnance packages. A lot of times they'd come off the station with one 2,000-pound bomb, which was not the kind of ordnance I needed. You know, if I was trying to knock a building down in Berlin, it might have been, but not trying to kill three guys running through a swamp. And later in my career, I also ran into the Canberra, the B-57, used in a close air support role. Not bad at all, but that was later on when I was with the Vietnamese Airborne Division. But that, in a nutshell, really, I think, runs down the at least the airplane types. Ordnance, Napalm was very good. CBU, cluster bomb unit, was excellent because there were a lot of tree lines in that area, but amount to hedgerows, but very long, and that's where the VC typically dug their foxholes and hid out. 20-millimeter cannon was good for the same reason. Bombs were relatively ineffective, again, because of the mud and because you had to deliver them very accurately if you're trying to blow up a bunker that's, you know, the size of a small dining room and you miss by 50 yards or even less probably, you didn't get it. So bombs were not the answer there, in my opinion. So I take a breath. You ask questions.
Okay, that was
did
great.
I cover it? Or?
No, that was great.
All right.
Let me ask you this, though. Did you ever find that the accuracy of some of those aircraft depended upon the pilot, that is, whether he was an Air Force pilot, Navy pilot, or Marine pilot?
Not to where you could make a consistent case for that, no. The answer is yes. There were certainly times when you knew you had a guy flying the airplane who was better than the guy you had 20 minutes ago. Same airplane, same load, better pilot. I mean, you could see that, and that's normal. But not consistently, not to where you could say Navy, except the Dixie Station, the young kids coming, what appeared to me to be guys right out of Pensacola that were on their first probably an operational assignment. That was my feeling anyway. Never confirmed it, could be dead wrong. But those guys were consistently not up to it. Other than that, I never noticed anything in particular.
Okay. What about
with airplanes.
What about with regard to the F-4? The reason I ask is... because, of course, Marine pilots would have been trained specifically for close air support missions usually, versus an Air Force F-4 pilot or Navy F-4 pilot, their role would have been, or their training may have been different. So
that's
curious,
right. That's right.
And did you witness a difference there?
Yeah, I think I did. I think the F-4 probably did a hell of a lot better when it went up to North Vietnam than it did trying to do close air support in South Vietnam.
Okay.
Navy and Marine F-4 pilots later on in my career when I was with the Airborne Division and up in the north, I think they did better, but I'll tell you, I just think the airplane inherently wasn't built for close air support. And another problem was legs. When an airplane arrives, comes to you from somewhere, and you've got a target that you want to work a piece at a time, and the guy says, you know, I'm bingo fuel, and you say, okay, make one pass and dump everything you got. This is not close air support, as it should be practiced. And many, many times that was the case with the F-4. It burned gas like crazy, particularly when it got down low. Mm-hmm. So it just was not the right airplane in my mind. The F-100 was decent. The A-4 was decent. And, again, the A-1 was just supreme. It was ideal.
And in terms of the fuel and other issues about loiter time, did you ever encounter other problems? For instance, I recall an interview with somebody where they discussed the problem of sometimes the fast flyers would come in, the jets would come in, and they had just refueled. And so they were so full on fuel, they couldn't really maneuver as well.
I didn't have that problem. You may have been talking with somebody who was facking up in the north, which might have been, and I have no clue as to what their environment was, except what I've seen in, newsreels like anybody else. No, I never had that problem. I never had anybody who said, I got to burn some before I can start.
Gotcha.
No.
Okay.
Not that I can remember.
Okay.
No.
All right. This ends the interview with Michael Maria.
Okay.
This is Steve Maxner continuing the interview with Mr. Maria. It is the 4th of January, the year 2001, at approximately 8:20 Lubbock time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas. And Mr. Maria is in Palm Harbor, Florida. All right, sir, why don't we go ahead and pick up with a discussion of your time at Duqua and Long On.
Okay. Let's see. Excuse me. Just to provide continuity, as I said, after a day or two, as best I recall at Benoit, just getting oriented, I was told that I was going to be assigned to a place called Duqua. I had no idea where it was. And that a helicopter would be available on the appropriate morning to take me out there. And so that is what happened. I packed up what little gear I had, uniforms and I think a couple of weapons and flak jacket and a few odds and ends, and met the helicopter on the ramp at Benoit and took a very short ride, as it turned out, basically straight west to Duqua Air Base, and landed on a small PSP or PAP, pierced steel planking or pierced aluminum planking ramp, probably 50 yards square if it was that. And I was let off, and the helicopter took off and disappeared, and I was standing there alone. And within seconds, I saw another military guy, a guy dressed in fatigues, walking toward me. And before he got to me, I realized that it was my old roommate, Dave Pinsky, my old roommate from pilot training. And so we had a kind of a surprise, a pleasant reunion there on the ramp. Dave was the only forward air controller assigned there at the time, and I was to be his partner. So we quickly reacquainted ourselves with what had been going on for about the, I guess, 4 years or so that we had been out of pilot training, and he got me settled in. By settled in, I mean this. Well, let me describe Duqua just a little bit. Very primitive place. It can be found on the map. It's, as I said, just west of the Saigon-Benoit area, on the banks of a river, the name of which escapes me. But again, very easy to find on a map. A runway, maybe 1,000 feet long, maybe 1,200 feet, dirt. PAP ramp, where we parked our airplane or two, depending on what we had, also had a Connex box on it where we kept our ordnance, our rockets primarily. And that was about it for the airfield. Immediately adjacent to the airfield were a series of buildings. They were cement block, most of them, and they were almost brand new when I got there. Matter of fact, within weeks of being finished. Nice-looking buildings, freshly painted, tile floors, windows, fans in the ceiling, very, very comfortable, even concrete sidewalks connecting them and connecting them to the common latrine that we had and the common mess hall that we had there. We, meaning myself and Dave, and a few Army advisors who were there to advise the local Vietnamese. Not sure if we covered this, but let's cover it quickly. The military structure was this way. Duqua was the airfield that supported operations in Haunia, Haunghia province. Haunia was the central province of the area of operation of the 25th Arvin Division, Tay Ninh province being the northern province, and Tay Ninh Airfield having a similar function there with similar contingent of facts and advisors assigned, and then Long An Airfield, which was in Long An Province, which was south of Haunia, and again, similarly arranged, a couple of facts and some Army advisors to advise the southern contingent of the 25th Arvin Division, which operated in that province. So that my job basically was, as it turned out, was to do visual reconnaissance in Haunia province, try and find what the enemy, almost entirely Viet Cong, no North Vietnamese at that time to speak of, what the Viet Cong were up to in Haunia province, and to interdict and interrupt their operations as best we could. Describe Haunia province just a little bit. Very flat, flat as a board, actually, almost all swamp, rice paddies, some diking to separate the paddies and provide some means of transit through the swamp. The other means of transit would have been small boats, sampans, really, in the canals that also crisscrossed the area. So it was basically a rice farming area, or had been. However, it had been, long before I got there, turned into what was called a free fire zone, which means that, and this may not be politically accurate, but as we understood it, which meant that basically no one lived there. No one could live there. And anything that moved in that area was considered a target, be it man or beast. So in that sense, it was an easy place to do reconnaissance and air operations in. Easy to see things if they were there, and easy to attack them once you saw them.
And that was the case for the whole province?
The best I recall,
wow.
Yeah, Steve. Okay. You'd have to look at a map, but basically that was it. It ran all the way from the river to the Cambodian border. And even into Cambodia, it was still pretty much swamped. The only activity, legal activity, so to speak, human activity in the province was right along the river. I remember, and it would have been on the east bank of the river only.
Mm-hmm.
There was a Nuoc Mam factory, rather large one, Nuoc Mam being a Vietnamese condiment similar to soy sauce, but more potent, saltier, and more strong in flavor, made from fermented fish.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, if you laid a fish in the sun long enough to rot, the brown juice that drips out of it is Nuoc Mam, or at least once you clean it up and put it in a bottle, it is.
Mm-hmm.
Not as bad as it sounds, actually, but very strong stuff. Anyway, there was a factory for Nuoc Mam along the river north of us, and very little else. So really our job was to prevent infiltration from Cambodia into the built-up areas of Benoit, Saigon, and whatnot, and that's what we did. Go ahead, Steve.
Well, I was just going to, one more thing about Hoang Nghi, just to clarify. The whole province, though, was considered by you as a forward air controller as a free fire zone.
That's right.
So anything moving in Hoang Nghi was
a target
of opportunity.
That's right.
Wow.
And again, I may be wrong on that,
mm-hmm.
but I don't think I am, and in any case, that represents my best recollection, yeah.
Now, the intelligence briefings you received concerning that province, did they focus primarily on the presence of Viet Cong units, NVA units, combinations?
My recollection, Steve, is it was nothing that formal. I don't remember ever getting an intelligence briefing anywhere. Either at Benoit, I think I might have gotten a very general sort of a description of the of Vietnam in general and how the war was being conducted, rules of engagement, don't fly below 1,500 feet, of course, was the major rule because that was considered the effective range of small arms fire.
Mm-hmm.
Basic, rules of safety, wear your helmet, which, as I think I've said already, we never did, or at least I never did, and things like that. But nothing in the way of detail. Everything that I recall that I got about Hoang Nghi province, I got from Dave Pinsky, who had been there before and knew what was going on, and he probably got it the same way from somebody who preceded him.
Okay.
I'm filling in some blanks here. As I may have mentioned at some point, and I don't know if I've mentioned this to you verbal or if it's in my written thing, so I'll mention it again briefly. I know, just because it had to be that way, that there were some Army people there who were advising the what I call the Central Regiment of the 25th Arvin Division and probably the artillery, the few artillery pieces that served the province. But I, honest to Pete, do not remember meeting them. I have no recollection of faces or names or anything of the sort, which goes to the comment that I've made before that in many, many ways, the entire experience of Vietnam, particularly the first two assignments, which were short, is pretty surreal to me. Sort of came and went. Maybe I was in a fog. I don't know. I don't think I was day to day, but maybe in a functional long-term sense I was. And I remember very, very little of my probably month and a half at Duqua. A couple of funny stories, which are, again, funny now. They certainly weren't funny then, but funny stories that I've recorded in the written document.
Mm-hmm.
The one about the Army general from the Research and Development Command who brought the Flechette rockets out to us and asked us to test them and all of that. But I won't go into that verbally. It's all in the written document. Go ahead.
Just for the sake of continuity within the interview,
could
you describe them somewhat so that there's a little bit, and people can also refer to the written document?
Describe what?
That particular incident?
That incident, yeah. That incident goes this way. Dave and I were, it's just one day, we probably got a radio call, said there's going to be an Army Brigadier General visiting you today.
Mm-hmm.
And he's coming out in a helicopter, and so we were prepared for him. He came out. I remember him being a little short, squatty guy, almost round in my memory. Again, he couldn't have been, or he wouldn't have been on active duty, but that's the way I remember him, very short and very broad. Army brigadier from research and development somewhere. He brought with him an helicopter, or actually I think a second helicopter followed him the next day. Brought with him a large supply of rockets that we had not seen before. They were the same as the ones we used, 2.75-inch folding fin aircraft rocket, FFAR.
Mm-hmm.
But the warhead, rather than a smoke or explosive, which we were used to, was a pink plastic nose cone, inside of which were hundreds, if not thousands, of flechettes, which are basically nails. I remember them being maybe an inch and a half to 2 inches long, with fins on them, so just like little darts. And when you fired this rocket, at some point in its flight, the spin, the centrifugal force acted on the pink plastic cover, blew it off, and what the effect of the rocket was it fired forward a this mass of flechette rockets, similar to what a shotgun would do,
mm-hmm.
And made a pattern of an impact pattern, depending on your altitude. The size of it would vary, but in my recollection, it wasn't too big. Maybe might have been 20 yards across at normal altitudes, something like that. But the idea was that we were to test these, and we were to fire them whenever opportunity arose at human targets on the ground,
mm-hmm.
And then if we were to kill a Viet Cong, we were supposed to get on the radio and call somebody who I have no idea, and they were going to come out and recover the body and do an autopsy. And so we, it seemed a little bizarre, but it was a weapon. And that was what we were up to. So we took a pretty good supply of them and did use them on several occasions, tried to keep one on the airplane all the time in one tube.
Mm-hmm.
And both Dave and I think, probably killed one or two VC at least with them, made the appropriate radio call. But in fact, to my recollection, we never recovered a body because, again, it was so swampy that frequently if you did kill an enemy soldier, they would just disappear in the mud, and that was the end of that.
Mm-hmm.
So they were still there, as best I know, when I left a month and a half later. And, again, we had used them. They seemed to be rather effective. But, again, we never did recover a body and never saw the general again. And, to my knowledge, never had anybody at least ask me for any follow-up on
them. Mm-hmm. Now, just out of curiosity, as a forward air controller, what did you think of this attempt to adapt the O-1, which had such limited fire ability,
mm-hmm.
Firepower ability, to try to turn it into some form of a... Was this for like a absolute last resort, you have to defend yourself weapon? Or
No. It was... Well, this was really a test, and I think probably intended more to be used on Army helicopters ultimately and
mm-hmm.
things of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
But we were convenient. We were probably the closest airfield to the Saigon-Benoit complex that was actually in an area where this sort of test could be easily accomplished because of the swampy area and whatnot. At least that was the thought initially.
Uh-huh.
So they were only given to us really to test. Now, but to go back to your point, we had already, we I think meaning all facts, had long since decided that to the degree that we could, we were going to become fighter aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And there were, again, in my notes, there are all kinds of ideas that people came up with. Just briefly to summarize those, I've talked from the sublime to the ridiculous. We used our smoke rockets as attack weapons if we had to. It was white phosphorus. It is a dangerous weapon.
Mm-hmm.
We used high explosive rockets. We almost always carried one or two of those. I have fired on many occasions an M40, might have been M70, but I think it was an M40 grenade launcher, shoulder-fired weapon, like a shotgun that fired a 40-millimeter grenade.
Mm-hmm.
I frequently used that from the airplane, rather effective into tree lines. Fired the M16 on more than one occasion to effect. People did throw hand grenades. I told you I never personally did that. I didn't think that was smart. What else? We had a side-mounted M60 machine gun in one of the O1s there at Duquois, and there are pictures of it available in various publications that are still mm-hmm. on the market. Mm-hmm. So that your standard Army crew served two-man, I guess it was considered a light machine gun, mm-hmm. fired the, what did it fire? 308 NATO round, I suppose.
Yes, it was an M60?
Yeah, M60 machine gun, and it was mounted in the back seat of the airplane as an experiment as well, and we used it on several occasions. I didn't think it was too useful for a couple of reasons, and, you know, and to the end, where I told you, I think, in the notes that I had a CIA guy once who just wanted to go out and see what the area looked like, mm-hmm. Cambodia and whatnot, who fired five rounds out of his Colt Detective Special at a couple of VCs, so... We did it all. The M60 machine gun, as long as I mentioned it, the reason I didn't like it, mm-hmm. it was a little awkward to operate from the front seat because you had to kind of reach over into the back seat and move what I think is called the charging handle. It mm-hmm. really operates the bolt mm-hmm. on the gun to get around into it and get it set up to fire. The worst thing was that most of the spent shells wound up in the airplane, and they presented a real danger of getting into places where they could foul control lines.
Mm-hmm.
And so probably more for that reason than anything else, I certainly wasn't crazy about the thing, and I think I only used it once or twice. But again, I have two photographs of that airplane configured that way.
Well, no, was the machine gun on the right side?
Shot out of the left. Whoops. Oh, boy. I'd have to look at the pictures. My first reaction was to say it shot out of the right side. That wouldn't make sense. The sight was on the left strut, and all it was a little piece of aluminum.
Okay.
And most pilots are more comfortable, for various reasons, making left turns than right. So I got to believe it was set up out of the left window.
Okay.
The photograph would confirm that.
Yeah. The reason I ask is because the charging handle, if I recall correctly, is on the right, and it's extremely hard to pull back.
Yeah.
It's not an easy weapon to lock and load.
Right.
So if it were on the right side of the aircraft, that would make it even more cumbersome to try to get a charge.
It was difficult.
Yeah.
It wasn't the greatest idea we'd ever see.
Uh-huh. So. Well,
all right, so yeah. that takes us to another sort of pause point.
Yeah, well, I'm just curious about the again, back to the Flechette rockets.
Mm.
Because those were eventually employed with the OV-10, weren't they?
I have no idea.
Okay.
That was the end of my experience with them.
Yeah.
Completely. So anything you know is more than I know on that subject.
I was just curious.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because it seems like maybe that in the context of a forward air controller test environment, I didn't know if maybe they were putting it on the O1 to test it to see if it would be effective for a better platform like the OV-10.
Well, I think, but the OV-10 was didn't even exist at the time, so I think that better platform, and particularly since this general was Army, would have been the helicopter.
Helicopter.
Yeah, the
okay.
UE. Yeah.
All right. Well, I will ask you to describe one more story based on your time at Duquois. And in your autobiography, little memoir you sent me, you talk about the only hairy mission, as you call it, when you were controlling the F-100s. Why don't you go ahead and
discuss which one
that.
Was that now?
This was in direct support of Vietnamese.
Is that where they started shooting the mortars? Is that that story?
Yes. They began firing more mortars in support as well. And you were, of course, a rather... low altitude.
I was really low. As best I recall, it was an afternoon. It was a beautiful day, as I remember, blue sky and all of that sort of thing. And we had a small unit of the local troops, probably a company, as best I remember, out doing a sweep operation somewhere in the province. And I remember them maneuvering on the ground. Everything looked pretty peaceful. I think I had done some pre-strikes just to soften up the area if there was anything there, and they had moved into the area, and I was just doing my circling overhead, keeping an eye on them, and they did run into contact. It was not what I would call heavy contact, but the small Vietnamese units in the Army weren't well equipped, they weren't necessarily well organized or led, although sometimes they were. And so a small contact usually meant stop. They weren't all that aggressive, and I can't say I blame them. They'd been at it for a long time with very little success. in any case, it quickly turned into a standoff between the two opposing units. Another factor is that when the friendlies knew that they had air, and I can see it from their point of view, why go charging in there and get yourself killed when you can just sit back, call in air, and have the job done that way? So, in any case, as I recall, that's what happened. It turned into a standoff. I called for some air, and I think actually before the air got there, as best I remember, I was trying to locate exactly where the enemy guys were, and I had gotten down very, very low, literally treetop, palm tree level. So I guess that denies something I said earlier, no trees. There were, I guess, a few palm trees growing here and there, but certainly nothing like dense foliage. And they were palm trees, now that I remember. Flying right at the top of the palm trees, probably under them, to be honest, at some point. So I might have been 25, 30 feet in the air at some point, which is good. If you're going to get low, you might as well get very low, because it's very hard to hit something going 100 miles an hour that's 30 feet in the air. Mm-hmm. What you don't want to be is in the intermediate altitudes, 500, 600 feet. That's really the most dangerous place. But in any case, I was zipping around trying to spot individual targets while the F-100s were on the way, if that's what they were. Again, I don't remember if that's what I said in the memoir. I guess it's true, but I don't remember. Point of the story is that at some point, a friendly unit nearby started firing mortars in support of the friendly troops who were now, they weren't really pinned down. They were just sort of taking a defensive position. And they started firing mortars fairly accurately, unfortunately, because they were hitting in the area where the hostile guys were, and which happened to be exactly where I was flying. And so what is today again a humorous picture that sticks very firmly in my mind is flying over shining blue water, because it was very wet in the area, shallow but very wet, because of the blue sky and these beautiful palm trees, and me just sort of lefting and righting and maneuvering around between and among them. And the next thing I knew, columns of water higher than I was, you know, exploding all around my airplane. And so, you know, it was a surprise and a shock. And the whole thing probably didn't last 15 seconds, probably not that much, until I got out of the immediate area and got to circling around the general area and got on the radio and called somebody on the ground and said, find out who's shooting those and either turn them off or... You know, we have to coordinate here. Mm-hmm. Either get them turned off or I'm not going back in if they're going to continue to fire, whatever. And it only lasted a few seconds and nobody got hurt, but it indicates how people do get hurt. There are stories in the, you know, in the verbal history, barroom verbal history of guys getting mortar rounds and artillery rounds through their airplane on more than one occasion, I think, further down the road, I'll tell you a story where I was involved in one. Indirectly, it wasn't my airplane, it was another guy. Mm-hmm. And it turned out everything worked out okay there, too, but that was later up at Queen Yan. If I forget it, you can remind me, because I don't think that's in the memoir now that I think about it.
I don't recall.
It's, you know, there's so many stories. But mm-hmm. In any case, yeah, that was just one of those things where, again, it teaches you if you're going to violate the rules, you better coordinate or... sooner or later you will get hurt, and it's one of those lessons you learn. You learn them very quickly. As I said, by the time I left Duqua, which was only probably a month and a half after I arrived, I felt like I was a very, very seasoned forward air controller. I'd probably controlled 100 or more airstrikes and had made a few mistakes, and in terms of the weather and fuel and the approach to combat situations and a lot of other things, and had learned from all of those, and I thought by then was in pretty good shape mentally to do the job. Mm-hmm. So that's really all there is to that story, as best I recall.
Well, you when we first started talking, you mentioned some of the only briefing you did receive regarded certain rules and things like that.
Yeah.
Don't fly below 1,500 feet.
And yeah.
Certain rules that were obviously broken.
Yeah.
That was one of them.
Oh, yeah. You had to do what you had to do. If things were normal, you tried to follow that rule, 1,500 feet. But But there were times where, for one reason or another, you couldn't follow it, and I don't think anybody followed it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
If they did, they probably didn't get a whole lot done.
Mm-hmm.
And rules in combat are a little different than rules somewhere else anyway. You know, it's they're rules of thumb, I suppose, or at least that's the way most of us looked at them,
mm-hmm.
To be abided by whenever possible. But you know, many, many years later, I had an Army officer I worked for who, you know, had a saying that said, you know, the reason they made you an officer was to break rules. You know, anybody can read the rule book. So
mm-hmm.
I guess there was some of that attitude there in all of us, and rightly so. Again, not wearing the helmet,
mm-hmm.
I think very few guys back, at least in the time frame, 66, 67, very few guys wore the helmet. The only thing it could protect you from was a head injury in a crash, and I think we presumed that if we got to that point, we had other problems on our hands, and it really did restrict your head movement because of its weight, your visibility, peripheral vision because of the ears, you know, the mass of the helmet, and most of all, you couldn't hear things. You couldn't hear your engine as well, which told you what the airplane was doing without even looking at the instruments. You couldn't hear the wind, which told you how fast you were going. You couldn't hear ground fire. You couldn't hear bombs bursting. All of those things were part of the environment that we flew in, particularly in the O-1, which was such an open airplane that really made you one with the whole battle environment. And putting on the helmet was just like putting your hands over your ears and a hand over one eye, at least in my opinion. It took you out of it took away a lot of sensory input that you needed to do the job right.
Mm-hmm.
So very few of us wore it. I don't even know where mine went. I didn't even carry it with me most of the time.
Was there any other equipment that you found affected you in that way?
Oh, yeah. The flak jacket was just the opposite. The flak jacket, if you could get three of them, you got three of them. You sat on one because the seat was just relatively thin metal, and a bullet coming up through the bottom of the airplane would still be going like crazy when it got to you. So if you sat on one flak jacket, doubled over, basically. You hung one over the back seat, not the back seat literally, but the back of the front seat, which would give you a lot more protection from anything coming in from the rear,
mm-hmm.
and then you wore one. Usually, I usually wore it loose, again, just to be a little more free in the cockpit. That is not zipped up or buttoned up. I forget which it did. I think it's zipped.
Mm-hmm.
But if you got into a more serious situation, you'd want to zip that up. And you felt at that point that you had armored yourself rather well, considering the airplane. So, yeah, whereas we were issued one, we managed pretty quickly, usually, to find two more.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most guys, again, would have done that.
Yeah. But what about other equipment that may have been debilitating in some fashion as far as sensory input or
no,
some other
nothing
perhaps physical restriction?
Nothing I can think of. Everything else was pretty comfortable. I mean, we flew in comfortable clothing. The airplane was so simple to begin with. We carried an M16. Usually, I think that we found some bungee cord arrangement where we hung it. I believe there was what was called a C4 light. It was a little like a flashlight mounted in the airplane, had a white light on one end and red on the other for night. And it was common in almost every airplane in those days. And it was positioned to the pilot's level right, just at the hinge of the door. And it was convenient to hang the strap of your M16 over it, as I recall. So most guys would have had their M16 sitting basically vertical off of their right knee.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it didn't get in the way. And so, well, it was there if you went down. At least you had something to defend yourself with. But on occasion, we did use it to attack ground targets.
Mm-hmm.
And hard to tell how effective it was. You can tell if you hit somebody. Usually you didn't know if you killed them or wounded them.
Mm-hmm.
And wasn't going to go down and try and find out. So.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, while we're on the issue of equipment and weapons, were you ever at a loss for anything that you wish you had something but didn't have it on hand?
Not directly, only indirectly, and it's well worth discussing. When I now see that brings another. You ask some good questions, Steve, because it triggers memories. At some point, either it had to be at Saigon because that's where it was, I did get a briefing in the TACC, the Tactical Air Control Center, which was the center that controlled close air support for the entire country, and then the direct air supports in the direct air support centers in the four corps worked subordinate to the TACC. I did get a TACC briefing, I guess, before going to Benoit. That would have been that one day I spent in Saigon. And the one thing I do remember, aside from the general, this is Vietnam, this is the geography, and this is how we do business, which I pretty much knew already, was we got a briefing on ordnance available. Mm-hmm. And in those early days, say February of 66, things were pretty bad in terms of the ordnance that was most effective. I wouldn't want to be quoted, but I guess I will be. But my recollection, to be honest, is that in country, in all of Vietnam, there were maybe 20 500-pound bombs. It was an extraordinarily low number. And the emphasis in the briefing was on that fact because we were told they're coming, they're making them, they're building them or getting them out of depots as fast as they can, but we're using them faster than we can get them because it was pretty much the standard weapon, 500-pound bomb. Mm-hmm. And there were very, very few. There were some others that were also in short supply, but that's the one that really sticks in my head. In general, my impression was that the good stuff was in short supply, and there was a lot of stuff that you would rarely use that they had enough of. Mm-hmm. Some of the weapons were, you know, 2,000-pound bombs. They're great for knocking down six-story buildings, mm-hmm. but they weren't good for what we were doing out in the swamp. And some of the wire-guided missiles, I think there was one called a bullpup. Mm-hmm. It was like a bomb, but it was actually a missile, and it was guided by a trailing wire, and the thing was frequently terrible. The wire would break, and the pilot would lose control of the missile, and lots of times you were pretty much where it was going. So I can remember one F-100 guy yelling, "Look out, FAC, it's gone ballistic," and I could see the missile just sort of corkscrewing down at me. Of course, it went to the ground a good enough distance away, but... Uh-huh. So that I do remember. If you're talking shortages, that's the only shortage I can think of. We had enough airplanes, I think. The equipment was good. The maintenance was good. Supply was good. You know, everything was the rockets, when we were first there, there were two kinds of white phosphorus rocket. One had a warhead that was what I would call slick. In other words, the contour of the rocket just smooth to a point, and it was ballistically more accurate than another one which we were using in the early going, which had kind of a bulbous warhead on it that I was led to believe was actually a warhead from an army recoilless rifle round, and it just wasn't as ballistically accurate as the one that I mentioned previously. We were given them, we were sort of told, look, they're in the inventory, you got to use them up. The faster you use them up, the sooner we'll be using just the good ones. So take them, shoot them, get them out of the inventory. And we did. They weren't that bad. If you could put a slick one within 20 yards of your target on a good day, you might have put this one within 40 or so. So it was. They weren't that much worse, but they were worse. Mm-hmm. Ballistically, yeah, I do remember that.
Okay. And what aircraft did you prefer coming in and support?
The A-1, definitely.
The A-1?
Yeah, and closely followed by the F-100.
Okay.
Yeah, those were definitely the two best.
And no shortages of napalm?
Not that I recall. Napalm was in pretty good supply and a very useful weapon where we were, yes. Mm-hmm. When you have troops hiding in tree lines and nothing but swamp on either side, the tree line becomes a very obvious target to the fighter pilot, mm-hmm. and because it's linear, it's an excellent target for napalm, mm-hmm. and we used a lot of it, mm-hmm. an awful lot of it, yeah.
But you, based on what you said earlier about sometimes knowing that you hit enemy with your own fire, whether it be from the M16 or whatever,
mm-hmm.
Did you ever get any kind of ground confirmation of enemy killed or enemy injured?
I have to think about that. I don't think so. Trying to think. No. No. Not that I recall.
Okay. No. Now, but you would have to submit reports up the chain of command.
No, we normally didn't,
no.
To tell you the truth. No. Again, in those early days, an after-action report was required. Things changed very rapidly, I think, Steve, after this time frame that I'm describing. We were still in the cowboy days, to use a term more loosely than I probably should. Very, very free to do what you wanted to do. Very, very little to no supervision. Once I left Benoit, that was it. It was just me and another FAC. We did what we felt like. After action report, I think, was required every 2 weeks. And they were extremely brief. I think we were asked to keep them to one sheet of paper. So it basically was number of sorties flown, maybe flew 10 sorties in 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. How many flights or fighters controlled, 40, 50, whatever it was. Numbers and types of ordnance used and results. 20 killed in action, 3 wounded, 5 bunkers, whatever it was. Mm-hmm. Very, very skeletal information. And unless you had some major action to describe, that was it. And a major action would probably have been more accurately described in an award write-up than in an after-action report.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I know in my case, one or two that came later events where I did get an award, I don't think I sent a report on them at all. It was just the award write-up that somebody else did recover that information.
Mm-hmm. Did you receive an award for anything that happened at DeClaw?
No. Air medals, one for every 20 flights, I think that was it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I didn't really do anything particularly exciting at DeClaw. A lot of just onesies and what I would call onesies and twosies. You'd spot two or three Viet Cong out in the swamp building something or, trying to move and it'd be a simple attack.
Mm-hmm.
You'd get up and fly in the morning and find something hidden under some trees that wasn't there the morning before, and you'd get a fighter and blow it up, and things like that. Very, very simple stuff.
Okay. Now, there were hazards to using napalm that aren't typically understood.
Okay.
Especially when you're dealing with air-breathing aircraft.
Right.
And you had an incident early at your time at
DeClaw. Right.
That involved napalm.
Well, right.
That's a pretty interesting story. Why don't
you
go ahead and talk about
it? All right. Again, the details, I don't remember what it was. It was at DeClaw.
Mm-hmm.
I was controlling, I think, F-100s again, almost sure it was in this case.
Mm-hmm.
And we were using napalm on some pre-planned targets, probably tree lines, things in tree lines. And I was very new at the time. Probably had been there a couple of weeks, I would guess, and for whatever reason was again flying pretty low, probably, I guess, 300 feet at this point, making a pass, just trying to see what the effect of the previous napalm can had been, and I flew the airplane, and fortunately I was in a dive and leveled out of the dive at 300 feet. And was starting to climb again when I flew through the remains of the napalm burst. And all I remember is very, very hot still. There was no flame, or I don't think I'd be here to tell the story, but smoke, a very thick black smoke with a very distinctive napalm smell to it, and very, very hot in there, only for a matter of a few seconds, I think. But the engine quit. The engine starved for air, and as I think I said in my memoir, I remember very distinctly being in an up swoop with a fair amount of airspeed, which was good because I had to restart the engine in flight, which was a fairly simple procedure. But again, as I mentioned in my memoir, the one thing I do remember very distinctly is looking at the propeller standing straight up and down, motionless, with the manufacturer's label very readable on the back of it. And I thought to myself, it's much more quickly than it takes to tell the story. I think the thought that went through my head was something like, you've just killed yourself. Very quickly got, I don't think the fighters actually ever even knew it happened. I didn't say anything. I just re-cranked it and you know, you wind up, that's one of those occasions where you wind up shaking like a leaf all over when it's over, not during the incident, but, you know, about a minute or two later, you're shaking all over the place, realizing how close you came. But, yeah, we do stupid things every once in a while. But, again, I think I did all my stupid stuff within the first month at Duqua, and when I left there, I don't think I had too many really stupid moves left in me, at least not unconscious stupid moves. Every once in a while, you had to do something that you knew was dangerous, but at least you were doing it consciously.
Well, so that wasn't something you were briefed on prior
no,
to Vietnam,
no,
that,
no.
that you've got to be careful because
napalm
absorbs all the oxygen.
Yeah, I think the answer to that would have been anybody would have thought you'd have been smart enough to know that on your own.
Wow.
But anyway.
Okay. Well, it would seem that your time at Duqua, and given the area that you were covering, very
yeah.
close to the Cambodian border,
right. yeah.
that the purpose for your being there
mm-hmm.
was to perhaps interdict any kind of infiltration activity through Cambodia,
right,
into South Vietnam,
and to prevent the. Well, ultimately, yes, from Cambodia, where there were North Vietnamese, I suppose, operating. But again, in those days, much smaller numbers
mm-hmm.
than became later.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, I think to keep them, you know, to keep them honest, at least in that piece of territory, make it difficult for them to use that territory as an infiltration route
mm-hmm.
to Saigon and Ben Hoa, which were major cities and it was the closest approach. So,
mm-hmm.
so in that sense, had we not been there, it would have been useful to them.
Mm-hmm. How effective do you think you and other military, American and Vietnamese, that is South Vietnam, South Vietnamese military activities were in that province?
I think it was effective, very effective, not necessarily because of us, by which I mean that it was a relatively simple job because of the terrain. It was literally impossible, I would say, for anyone to get from the Cambodian border across Hanoi province in a night. So anybody who made the attempt, no matter how he tried it, was going to be exposed at some point during the day. And if you made the reconnaissance daily, which we did, it was going to be very, very difficult for somebody to get across, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I think we were very effective, but again, against an enemy which was probably small in numbers and had a lot going against it. In terms of, particularly in terms of the terrain that they would have had to operate in. There was no way they could build anything of any size at all without us seeing it, a road or a depot or bunkers or nothing. I mean, there was just nothing that could be done without us seeing it and destroying it the next day. So it was a wasteland.
Now, you mentioned earlier that the only area that where legal traffic
mm-hmm.
Was allowed was on the river.
Yeah.
I assume the river came down from Cambodia.
No, it was more north-south than that. I think it just came probably down from the Central Highlands and emptied out into the Mekong Delta. Probably became part of the Mekong River at some point. I could look up, tell you what the name. It was Vam Co something, Vam Co Dong or Vam Co Lam.
Mm-hmm.
The words meaning Vam Co whatever meant the river of, to the east, and the Vietnamese language is extremely simple language, by the way. It was, as I understand, a created language. It wasn't a real language. It was created by the French or somebody. But Vam Co Dong meant the river to the west, and Vam Co, whatever the other one was, meant the river to the east, and there were two rivers that ran parallel to each other fairly close together.
Mm-hmm.
And the one I'm talking about was the one that was west.
Okay.
Like I said, Nuoc Mam, the sauce that I was telling you about, Nuoc was the Vietnamese word for water, so water was Nuoc. Nuoc Da was ice, which means water frozen, and Nuoc Mam meant water fish.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very primitive language. Again, the river was just the river that is west.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And again, it's easily found on a map.
Right. Did you ever receive orders or authorization to fire on targets of opportunity on the river? That may have been an
No. Wouldn't can't imagine why we would have. The river was considered free commerce. Mm-hmm. Now, if we found something on the West Bank, theoretically, at least, it was a target.
Okay.
You know, you had to use your head about something like mm-hmm. that. But no, the river was free commerce.
Okay. Do you think that the Vietnamese, the Viet Cong, the NVA exploited that?
Oh, absolutely. Because they would just mix in with all the commercial traffic, fishermen and, you know, people going to the grocery store and all of that sort of thing. Yeah, I'm sure they did. But there was they had to be coming from someplace in country and going someplace in country in order to do that.
Gotcha.
But I'm sure there were plenty of them there, yeah.
Well, is there anything else you want to talk about with your time at Duquoise?
Can't think of anything. No, just again to reiterate that it was would have been sort of a cozy little hole to hang out in for a year, you know, kind of a nice little place with a few guys that had a job to do. The physical comforts were not bad at all, but beyond that, I do have photographs of it that Dave Pinsky has subsequently sent me mm-hmm. from his time frame, aerial photographs of the airfield, some photographs of the buildings and whatnot, and the ramp and all of that, but and some of the guys that were there later with him, but no, that's it, I think, for Duquoise. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
This will end the interview with Mr. Michael Maria on the 4th of January, 2001.